Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies. Yeah!
You have chosen wise.
All right, hello and welcome to the 100th episode of Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who never thought we'd make it this far.
Mike DiGricio.
You doubted us at every turn, Mike.
I had no faith. None.
You were like, you know what, when we started this podcast back when we were in college,
yes,
right? And we had a studio back then, right? Everything was good. But we only, like, we started this with, like 5 months left of college to go or something like that.
Right.
And so when college was wrapping up, we were both like, huh, I guess we should figure out how to keep doing this or else we have to stop.
Yeah, we're about to move to different cities and have no idea what we're doing.
Yeah, so for the first like 7 episodes of this podcast, we had a studio and it was amazing. And we were doing it face-to-face and it was cool. And we've been doing it on Skype ever since. But it worked out. We made it to 100 episodes, Mike. It's pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say good on us, you know?
Yeah, and
we deserve credit, is what I'm saying.
Exactly. We're just going to pat ourselves on the back for this entire episode.
Yeah. I hope you didn't want us to talk about movies, because we're going to talk about ourselves.
Exactly. We're going to talk about how great we are. First, I'll go talking about myself, and then Mike will talk about himself. And then we'll bring on special guests to talk about each of us individually, and then we'll wrap up without referencing a single movie at all.
Yeah, that's so buckle up, kids.
Of course, we're not going to do that. Actually, we didn't really plan anything for the 100th episode.
Nope.
Other than just delivering a great episode of Film Bookcast, which I think is the best way to celebrate, right?
Yeah, our gift to you is everything that we've always done.
Exactly.
Now, nothing's changing.
Exactly. Nothing's changing. It's all exactly the same. Because that's what you've already decided that you like. And we want to give you what you like. So let's keep this going. Credit for all of our theme songs goes to Kyle Cullen. If you want to contact us, you can send us an email at mikeandmikegotothemovies@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts if you can, since it helps people find the show and makes us feel good about ourselves when we get those good reviews. Now, if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before and you're just starting out in episode 100, then I'm sorry we spent that entire intro just talking about how great we are, but first, we usually start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately, and that can be anything, movies, TV, books, video games, music, whatever we want to talk about, that goes in the discussions category. After that, we move on to our featured review, and what better way to celebrate 100 episodes of Film Bookcast, Mike, than with a Marvel movie?
Yeah, I mean, we've always joked about how this should really just be the Marvel cast. I hope you're ready for 3 hours of episode 100 jokes and talking about Marvel, because
exactly,
that's what's coming.
Yeah, we'll try to throw in some other jokes, too. We'll say, like, oh, Shrek 5, haha, whatever.
But check the minutes, Colin.
Check the minutes, Colin. Despite starring in Rage, he is still just Nicolas Cage.
Okay,
that's from our other podcast. But anyway, so today we are talking about a brand new Marvel movie, and that is the new movie directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, the 21st movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It is Captain Marvel, and this movie has been just fucking dominating at the box office this past weekend. Mike, I don't know if you saw the numbers.
No, I did not.
You haven't followed this at all?
Well, I saw that it was number one. I didn't get the exact number, though.
Well, let's just say worldwide box office gross is something like $450 million, which puts it at the sixth highest opening weekend gross of all time.
Damn.
And the second highest MCU opening weekend gross of all time, just behind Infinity War.
Holy shit.
Right?
That's fucking awesome.
That's insane. I could not, like, you know, I was excited about this movie, too, and I get it. Like, it's a new Marvel movie. It's the first Marvel female superhero, so I get that. But, like, this is, you know, Captain Marvel. And as far as, like, known characters go, Captain Marvel is probably more well-known now because of, you know, the marketing push for this movie. But, like, you know, before, like, a year ago, you know, it was only, like, nerds like us who knew who Captain Marvel was.
Right.
And that's kind of what Marvel has become so good at, is taking these characters that are relative pop culture obscurities and turning them into phenomenons. like they did with Black Panther last year. And even then, like I did not expect this movie to outgross Black Panther at its opening weekend.
Yeah, holy shit.
You know, that's insane. But this, you know, a bigger opening weekend than any of the Iron Man movies, any of the Captain America movies, any of the Thor movies. Like, holy shit. That's pretty big.
The future is now our old man. That's it.
Exactly. So we're going to get into our thoughts on Captain Marvel later on in the episode. But right now, let's talk about some film news. Alright, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we got a few things to get through today. First of all, you know, last episode we talked about the Oscars, right, Mike?
Yes.
And we talked about, you know, the fact that, you know, it was a fun award show, but a lot of the awards went to stuff that we didn't feel was particularly deserving. And for me, one of those big awards was for Rami Malek, who won Best Actor for Bohemian Rhapsody. A lot of people would disagree with me on that. Some people think he's very good in the movie. That's fine. But some people will tell you the Oscars don't matter. But I think with this news, it proves that they do. Because Rami Malek is now in talks to play the villain in the new James Bond movie. And I think if he didn't win that Oscar, he would not be. I don't think he would even, like, his name wouldn't have even come up. You know, so it's, you know, it's that kind of thing. And even just thinking about, you know, Captain Marvel, Brie Larson won an Oscar for Room, and a year later she was cast as Captain Marvel. And so, you know, if she didn't win that Oscar, the movie that we're reviewing today would look a whole lot different than it does. So yeah, the Oscars do have weight in the industry, and Rami Malek possibly playing the villain in the new James Bond movie. So, Mike, what do you think of that casting choice?
You know, I can't say that I've seen Rami Malek in a whole lot off the top of my head. I don't watch Mr. Robot. I didn't get to see Bohemian Rhapsody. So I don't particularly remember anything that he's from.
You know what I discovered that he was from? I thought I didn't know Rami Malek from a lot of things, because I also did not watch Mr. Robot. And I had seen Bohemian Rhapsody, and I had seen him in Short Term 12, which also stars Brie Larson, by the way. And that's a very good movie. But you know what I discovered that he was in that I didn't know about until like recently? He was the like the Pharaoh in the Night at the Museum movies.
Oh my God! Yes, he is.
He's like King Tut or whatever in those movies. It's
yeah,
yeah. So so you do know Rami Malek as that.
As long as the villain is a whimsical British Egyptian pharaoh, like, yeah, he's got it. that only comes alive at night. Right. Yeah, like, I'm down. From what I've heard about his, like, character in Mr. Robot and stuff and his performance, like, yeah, I think he can do, like, this kind of weird, like, emotionally dead, creepy character. And, like, I'm in. Like, yeah, sure, why not? I feel like I don't remember a whole lot. I know we always bring it up with the news for the new Bond movie, but I can't remember what the current status is. Like, I think Danny Boyle's out, right? And they're using all new directors and stuff.
It's Cary Fukunaga's directing this one.
Like, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, I'm fine with it. I feel like at this point, Bond may be jumping a shark for me, personally. I don't really know. We'll see. I don't feel excited about Bond 25 anymore.
Okay, interesting. I am excited about it because, I mean, it is Daniel Craig's last round as James Bond. And he is my favorite Bond, so I'm excited to see how he goes out. I am curious how it's going to be, because, yeah, I was kind of excited for whatever Danny Boyle was going to bring to it. He was always a weird choice for a Bond movie, but, like, he could have delivered something really interesting. But Cary Fukunaga is a great director, too.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely.
A pretty phenomenal one, actually. So I am still pretty excited about James Bond 25. I know Lea Seydoux will be back. I don't think there's any word yet on if Christoph Waltz is coming back as Blofeld, which, you know, that's the thing. I feel like, you know, if Rami Malek is coming in as a villain, Christoph Waltz might not be in the movie. And in Spectre, it seems like it's kind of setting up Christoph Waltz to still be in these movies in some way. But at the same time, like, I don't think you would lose that much in not having him in the time around.
I suspect they'll do sort of like a Moriarty kind of thing. Like, you know, in Sherlock Holmes, there's the main villain of the story, the whatever current thing you're watching, you know, or reading. And then also there's this background villain. I assume that'll be what's happening with Blofeld.
Yeah, it's possible. So we'll see what happens with that movie. I am very curious about it. And it's coming out, I think, in like May of next year. So we should be getting more updates on it in the near future. But I think Rami Malek could do like I'm thinking of like Javier Bardem in Skyfall. Like, I feel like Rami Malek could be channeling that kind of performance. All right, and in other news, Mike, we've talked about this quite a bit recently, that James Gunn, the exonerated filmmaker of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. He's no longer making those ones. Is exonerated the right word? Exiled? Is that the...
Exiled. Exonerated means, like, cleared of all charges. So, I don't know about that word.
Exiled from Disney, but hired by Warner Brothers to kind of tackle the Suicide Squad movie that they're making. So, obviously, there was a Suicide Squad movie. It was bad. And it was severely modeled after the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. So, now that the guy who made Guardians of the Galaxy is available, they got him. but it sounds like this will be like a pretty like kind of soft to hard reboot of the entire thing. And to that end, they're actually recasting one of the major characters in Suicide Squad. Will Smith played Deadshot in that first movie, and now he will be played by Idris Elba in James Gunn's Suicide Squad 2.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting, actually.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And it's a surprise because I feel like, you know, like I think Will Smith was one of the sole bright spots in Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
Like, I think the chemistry that he has with Margot Robbie and, like, their kind of back and forth, like, that's fun to a degree in that movie. But Idris Elba's a very different performer than Will Smith. Like, he's charismatic as hell, like, Idris Elba, of course, but, like, it's just a very different kind of charisma that Will Smith carries himself with, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you really think about how Will Smith is, like, or was, it might still be, like, the most bankable actor in Hollywood, apparently. And for him to drop out seems like a not great, for his star power not to really work for Suicide Squad, the first one, and then for him to drop out of the second one, like, seems to be very foreboding, right? Or be a bad omen for that movie. But, like, you replace it with Idris Elba, like, that's a pretty solid get, you know?
It's not
some random no-name guy.
Exactly. And the less we have to do with the first Suicide Squad, probably for the better.
So
there is no word yet on if Harley Quinn will be in this movie either. I know Margot Robbie is making the Birds of Prey movie as Harley Quinn.
Right.
So there's no really, like, she might be in this movie, she might not be, like, they're not really revealing that yet. But they did reveal a lineup of characters that James Gunn is using for this movie. And they are amazingly D-list characters. Like, characters that you would not expect to see in, like, a major comic book movie. Like, they're going to be in here, apparently. So King Shark is one of them. And I am a fan of King Shark through the CW TV shows. He pops up on The Flash every once in a while, and it's literally like this gigantic kind of human shark hybrid. He has pants. It's great.
Is he a street shark? Is he just like a straight up street shark?
Yeah, he's like street sharks. You're a street shark.
That's amazing.
I forgot about street sharks, but yes, you're entirely right. It's basically street shark. Street shark.
By all means, you first.
Thanks.
Reminds me of Jaws. They didn't show the shark because they couldn't afford to make it look good.
How long do you think he'll stay asleep?
I like Shark Week. I'm not a marine biologist.
And then you have Ratcatcher, who is a Batman villain who has the power to speak to and to control rats. So there's
interesting.
That. Kind of like Ant-Man, but with rats, and it can't shrink. Mm-hmm. You have Polka Dot Man, who has a suit that is entirely covered in polka dots that he can rip off his suit and they turn into various weapons, from what
that
I understand.
Is the best ability of all time.
It could be a great ability. And then you've got Peacemaker. And the only description that I've seen of Peacemaker is that he loves peace so much that he's willing to kill for it.
I'm hyped for this movie. You got a motherfucking street shark and a murderous pacifist. I'm in.
And the best part, the murderous pacifist, James Gunn wants Dave Bautista to play the role.
This is going to be the best movie. This is our new Citizen Kane.
It's you might not be that far off. I think this it has the potential to be really cool. And I don't want to be excited about a Suicide Squad movie again. I was already burned on that, you know?
Yeah.
But I love James Gunn, man. And I loved what he did with the Guardians movies. And I am very excited to see him kind of operating within this, like, grimier world of that Suicide Squad can be, especially, and, you know, that kind of reflects the earlier movies that he made in his career. I think this could be really cool, especially with, like, that kind of D-list lineup of, like, just expendable characters. Because I feel like in a Suicide Squad movie, like, a lot of these characters have to die by the end of the movie, right? Like,
it's called Suicide Squad.
It's like, in the name, it's part of the premise, and the first one really pulled back on that. Like, a couple of them die. Right, I mean, you know, there was Slipknot, the man who can climb anything, who does die in like 5 minutes.
He was killed to prove a point, I guess.
Exactly. And then I think it was the fire dude who dies also towards the end of the movie. But I remember basically nothing about it, so there's that. But this looks like it could be a lot of fun, especially with Idris Elba kind of leading this cast. Like, that's pretty cool. So yeah, James Gunn, Suicide Squad 2, we'll update you more on that as things come out. But that is supposed to hit sometime in 2021. And now let's move on into some Disney Plus news, Mike. I think this was really interesting. This came out this past week. Bob Iger, CEO of Disney, had this kind of conference call where he kind of let slip some like various news stories. Somebody did ask him about National Treasure 3.
Really?
And yeah, and he said there's no active development plans in that movie at this time, but they're still trying to work on it. So, you know, we'll see what happens. The Cage Sans, once National Treasure 3 hits, the Cage Sans will really be in full force, I think.
Yes, that's what we're waiting on.
One thing that he mentioned during this call that got a lot of attention is that apparently Disney Plus will have the entire Disney library of movies at its disposal. So it will all be on there. And that includes everything locked away in the Disney vault. Right, so like if you missed out on that Blu-ray of Bambi that was only available for a month or something, like it will be on Disney Plus. You'll be able to watch it through that streaming service, and that's huge if true, right? Like that's a huge thing because the Disney library is massive. That's thousands and thousands of movies theoretically. At the same time, I don't know if it actually will have every single thing that Disney ever released.
I mean, yeah, probably not. If you really think about it.
Just because, like, once you open up that can of worms, and it's like, and one of the things that like everybody on Twitter was saying, we're like, are they going to put like Song of the South on there, or like,
yeah,
which you know, if you don't know Song of the South, that's that's such a weird movie in Disney's canon because there are so many of its most iconic songs are from Song of the South, right? Like Zippity Doo Dah is from Song of the South. Right. And there's literally, like, you have the ride Splash Mountain in Disney World, which is based on Song of the South. But the movie Song of the South hasn't been available to watch since, like, the 80s, I don't think, because it is notoriously racist.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And I think they could theoretically release Song of the South if, you know, you put it in the proper historical context. You have, you know, critics and filmmakers, like, kind of discussing what Song of the South was and like all that kind of thing. But I don't think they're going to do that on Disney Plus. That doesn't seem like their thing. They're not film struck, you know, it's
no, they're not going to get what the dude from TCM, Ben, whatever, what's his name?
Ben Mankiewicz.
Mankiewicz. Yeah. 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 I don't think they're going to get him to come on and introduce the movie. They're just going to probably not even put it on there. And if they do, they'll probably do it devoid of historical context. And then it'll be a big controversy.
Right, exactly. But it's not even just Song of the South. I mean, there are so many, like, Disney cartoons from, like, the 30s and 40s that are incredibly problematic when you look at them today that I just very much doubt will actually be available on Disney Plus. I'm sure Disney Plus will have a lot of stuff. And I think when he says, like, the entire Disney library of movies, he means, like, you know, those classic Disney movies that everybody loves. You know, that, you know, you can't get that easily anymore. But,
yeah,
like, there's so much Disney shit, not even just, like, you know, problematic stuff, but just stuff that, like, no one gives a shit about. That, like,
right.
You know, that might be interesting to watch as, like, you know, if you're a film geek or something, if you're doing any complete works of Kurt Russell or something, you're going to have to watch all those 60s Disney movies that he was in. But there's, like, a lot of
foreshadowing.
just throwing it out there. if those movies are available on Disney Plus, that's season 2 complete works, Mike.
Yeah, who knows?
But you know, it's just it's a weird thing. I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Disney library, and I think it would be huge if they actually did that. And I think if they actually did do that, that would be a great thing if they put it all out there, because that would kind of send out the challenge to every other studio and being like, hey, your move, like you got to do this too now, or else you're behind, basically.
Yeah. Disney can wave their, you know, flex some muscles, I guess I'll say, about how they completely, like, destroyed copyright. And we're like, look, we have everything now here. Pay us for it. So, like, to that end, I can't wait to pirate everything that gets put up on Disney Plus, because there's no way in hell I'm paying for that show. Like, on principle, I'm not going to subscribe to Disney service.
Okay. All right, Mike. Fair enough. I mean, there is going to be a lot of original content on there as well.
Yes.
And, you know, several Marvel things, several Star Wars things. And actually, one Marvel thing that was just announced today, an animated What If show that Marvel is producing for the Disney Plus streaming service. Now, are you familiar with the What If line of Marvel comics?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, so basically, they've been doing this since, like, the 70s. Every once in a while, Marvel will just publish a what-if comic. So it's, like, an alternate universe Marvel comic that kind of depicts, like, you know, what if, like, the thing that we know happened, but slightly differently. Like, how would that affect the universe or these characters and stuff? So you would have issues like, what if Loki was the one who was destined to wield Thor's hammer instead of Thor? Like, how would the universe be different in that regard? And so you would have an issue about that. And then they get, like, really, really weird and obscure. Like, there's one, I think, from the 80s where it's like, what if the original Marvel bullpen became the Fantastic Four? And there, it's, it's literally an issue where, like, Stan Lee is Mr. Fantastic and Jack Kirby is the Thing. And, like, it's, you know, they got nuts with it, basically.
Yeah. I mean, and, like, why wouldn't they, right? Like, you have, at this point now, you know, 40 years, 50 years, whatever it is, of comics.
Yeah.
And characters, I mean. Just fucking get weird. Just do, like, what happens if, I can't even think of any, you know, Galactus fights the Hulk. Like, I don't know. Like, why not? Do some weird shit.
Well, A, I'm sure that's happened at some point, but...
I'm sure, yeah.
But, yeah, no, you're right. And, I mean, Marvel's been doing the weird shit for basically their entire 50 years of being around. But, yeah, so they're kind of doing this animated What If anthology series on Disney+. That would theoretically involve at least some of the cast members of the Marvel movies reprising their roles.
Interesting.
Which I think would be pretty cool. I think it would be even cooler if this was like a live action show. But I understand why that wouldn't happen. Like the time, like I don't think they want to put like that much time and effort into a show that basically doesn't really amount to anything more than like, well, what if this happened, you know?
Yeah.
but as like kind of an animated lark, like I think this could be pretty neat.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Can't wait to torrent it.
Man, you are so adamantly against this Disney Plus streaming.
Yeah, and I can't really explain why. I don't know. It's just like a gut feeling.
That is the Disney Plus news, and it theoretically might have every Disney movie ever, but it probably won't. But it will still probably have a lot. And then finally, one last bit of film news, and this is kind of the big one that came out over the past couple of weeks. After the Oscars, you know, Green Book won Best Picture, and, you know, that everything happened the way it happened. A couple days later, these articles started making headlines of about Steven Spielberg, who was like sort of leading this committee to kind of try to alter the rules of what makes a movie eligible for Academy Award consideration. And this sparked a lot of debate.
Discourse,
yes. Hashtag film discourse. And I wanted to get your take on this, Mike, because I have a lot of very complex feelings about this whole situation. I feel like what happened is a lot of people read, like, a headline, and they were like, ah, oh, Spielberg's an old man, fuck him, and then this.
Yeah.
And that's really, like, it's really way more complicated than that. But basically the idea is that Spielberg, along with, like, this committee, and really it's, like, the committee, like, Spielberg's the face of it. It's not, like, just him. You know.
Right.
But anyway, Spielberg's kind of like going to the Academy. And I don't know where they landed on it or if they've met yet. Cause I think the news has kind of died down on this whole thing. Basically Spielberg tried to lengthen the theatrical window that movies would have to play in theaters in order to be considered eligible for Oscars. And people took this as a slap in the face to Netflix specifically, because then a movie like Roma, for example, couldn't get the Oscar love that it got during this Oscar season. I think Spielberg is in the wrong on this, because I think I would like to err on the side of inclusivity. But I also get his point, where it's like, yeah, I think his exact quote was that, like, you know, at what point does it become television or whatever? Like, should Roma be considered for Emmys instead of Oscars or whatever? Because if you think about it, you know, HBO is, like, a television channel or whatever, and they always do Emmys and stuff, even for their movies, right? And, like, HBO, for example, acquired The Tale out of Sundance with Laura Dern. And that was a movie that was produced independently, like, completely on its own. And HBO picked it up and then aired it on TV, and then it was considered for Emmys. But Netflix does the exact same thing, where they buy movies at Sundance, and then they kind of push them for Oscars, and they get Oscar consideration. So it kind of raises the question of, like, what is considered a movie, and what do we consider, like, is it just in terms of its distribution, its exhibition, like, all that kind of stuff. So I'm curious kind of where you land on this whole debacle, Mike.
I feel like... I disagree with Spielberg. I forget, like, because right now the current standard is, I think it's 2 weeks in L.A. and New York, or one or the other.
It has to play in theaters for 1 week, At least one theater for 1 week, I believe, is how it works.
Right. Something bizarre.
Yeah, I believe there's like there's literally like a designated theater in LA where like they will play like movies for 1 week, so you can
just dump movies.
Yeah, so they can get eligible for Oscars, you know, that kind of thing. And people will literally like, I think even when like when Tommy Wiseau made The Room, he bought out a theater for a week so that he could get eligible for Oscars because he was that deluded. Like people do,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, and I believe it about Tommy Wiseau. So I think it is very arbitrary in general, like that type of rule. And I think I agree with you that you said it, like we should err on the side of inclusivity. Making it more difficult for people to make movies, or not make movies, get movies
recognized,
and for the most, like, get recognized by the body that is meant to recognize movies, right? Like,
right.
The Academy and stuff should not be a thing. Like, I don't think we should make it harder for that to happen. That was a big response from Netflix, and I think a lot of Ava. Oh my God, I forget DuVernay. I forget her first name.
Ava DuVernay
put a whole statement out, I think, at least her Twitter thread or whatever, about how Netflix gives disadvantaged filmmakers a chance that studios and other entities would never, you know, particularly people of color and women filmmakers and stuff like that. They can go to Netflix and get a movie made and have it be eligible for these things. So I think that is a huge factor. I also think it has an air of elitism to it, right? Like the biggest filmmaker in Hollywood at this point would of course never have a problem getting a movie made that would then be eligible for Oscars, right?
Right.
So of course he thinks making it harder doesn't really matter. And I don't mean like he's putting his proposal was to put an extra barrier, right? Like make it have to play for longer. A lot of theaters, I think I read like AMC won't even play Netflix movies, AMC theaters sometimes,
right?
Or will make it harder for them. I think when, you know, a lot of movies come back out after Best Picture nominations have been announced, and I think AMC refused to show Roma again. And stuff like that.
Right. But this isn't really the fault of the theaters. This is the fault of Netflix. Because Netflix is very non-transparent when it comes to who's actually watching their stuff. And they put Roma in theaters for about 3 weeks, actually, when they originally put it out. I think they put it out for a few theaters in 1 week, and then it expanded and expanded and stuff. I think it was out for 3 weeks. So it's actually like 1 week short of what this eligibility period would have required anyway. But they also didn't report the box office numbers, which is something that no one does. Like, no one doesn't report their box office numbers, you know?
Right.
Like, even if they're bad. But Netflix didn't do it. They didn't report their box office numbers, and they never report they never tell you how many people watch something, because they, like, unless the numbers are, like, impossibly good. Remember, like, when Bird Box came out, they were like, 40 million people watched this in its opening weekend, and it's like, but did they, though? Like,
yeah.
Like, because
how many people
made
it 20 minutes in?
Yeah, there's no way for us to know that 40 million people actually watched this movie. For all we know, like, you know, 5 million people watched it and, like, made memes about it and they got spread around online. Like, that's...
Right.
Or, like, 40 million is, like, a really, like, inflated number by, like, say, yeah, this person watched, like, 1 minute of the movie, they count.
Right.
You know, in the same way that, like, when you scroll past a Facebook Live video or something, like, your view gets counted even though you just scroll past the video.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, like, Netflix, I think if this rule was implemented, it might force Netflix, if they want to get recognized by Oscars, to actually put out more of their movies in theaters, which I think would be a good thing.
Yeah, I guess. I don't really know. I don't know if that, you know, it becomes such like a culture issue in general. Like, you know, movie ticket prices are rising. You know, it's so expensive to go to a movie now in a lot of places that putting these movies on Netflix gives them an opportunity to be seen by people that would have never had a chance to see them before. Now, you can't, obviously, you can do both things. Like, it could be on, you know, Roma is on both. And I think that a lot of theaters, I read something, I don't remember exactly, they were like, require an exclusivity window where, like, if we're going to show your movie, it only has to be in theater. It has to be in theaters for X number of days before you put it live on Netflix.
Right.
And I don't remember exactly what that number of days is.
Right. Which, by the way, that's how Amazon has been playing it, too. Like, Amazon has produced their own original movies, but they always put it out in theaters first, and then maybe it comes to Prime, like, 3 months later or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. It's, like, a whole weird thing. I feel very conflicted about it. I also saw someone, I think, dug up a Variety article or something from 1999 or 2000, about how Amblin Pictures had, like, in their contract at the time that any movies they produced would not be put out on DVD yet because they didn't feel it was a suitable format, which is hilarious. So it just feels very, like, you know, like you said, you know, old man yells at cloud. So I don't know. I guess I'm of two minds about it. I am in favor of movies being more accessible no matter what. So if you're going to make it more difficult for Netflix to, like, be considered a movie, quote unquote, right? That whole, like, conversation you were talking about.
Right.
I think you're on the wrong side. I don't know what the answer is. I guess I feel like they're making films and they should be recognized as films.
Right. And I agree with that. I think they should be recognized as films. But in the process also, like, something like HBO, like I mentioned, like, their stuff should be eligible for Oscars too, if they want it to be, you know, like, like with something
they
like
could
the, something
buy
like the
that
tale.
Theater for a week.
Yeah, I mean, they probably could, but with something like The Tale, like Laura Dern, like, she's amazing in that movie, and I think she got nominated for an Emmy. She might have even won. Like, I think if that was released in theaters or something, or if it had gotten like an Oscar push, it could have gotten nominated for Oscars. It could have. Yeah. And, you know, HBO has worked with good directors in the past, like Steven Soderbergh and stuff. But then it even, like, there's even, like, the question, like, I remember when Twin Peaks The Return was airing on TV, and, like, film critics, like, co-opted it as, like, this is a movie. And it's like,
right.
And I was like, no, this is a TV show. It's a great, it's an amazingly produced TV show, but it is a TV show. But at the same time, like, the filmmakers, like David Lynch said, like, oh, well, this is an 18-hour movie that I split over 18 parts. And it's like, yes, that is the definition of a TV show, but it's... Yeah. but you know, it's just there's so much, like, I think gray area that has come in between that that TV show movie divide over the last, like, 5 years.
Oh, absolutely. I think as a lot of that gets, like, democratized, right? Like, you know, season 7, 8, whatever, fuck, get last season of Game of Thrones, I can't remember,
right?
You know, it's 6 episodes that are each are feature length. They're like an hour and a half long each, like,
right?
Is that 6 movies? Like, I don't know. It's weird.
Right. Like, at the Oscars next year, are we going to see, like, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Knives Out, these are my dream Oscars, The Irishman, and also the Game of Thrones finale, like, in the Best Picture races?
So, I don't know. And I feel like it we're going to have, like, a weird, you know, we're going to have to come to terms with this, like, as a society of film geeks.
Right.
Of, like, not my movies. You know, we need to realize that times are changing, the way stuff is produced and distributed and it is different now. And we have to figure out to define what each category is and stuff.
Yeah. I will also say, you know, speaking of Roma and speaking of Netflix, I think, like, Netflix produces so much stuff and I feel like they never get the push that Roma did. Right. I mean, like, they really rallied behind Roma. They saw that movie and were like, this could be our big chance at an Oscar. And it almost was. I mean, they won, like, a bunch of Oscars for it, but it could have been their best picture thing. But, like, with all their other movies, you know, there's been an occasional Oscar nomination. Like, I mean, Ballad of Buster Scruggs got nominated this year. But, like, Roma has stayed in the cultural conversation much longer than every single Netflix movie has. Because Netflix has treated it like it was a real movie. And they actually, like, advertised it and they put it out in theaters and they put a campaign for Oscars for it. Whereas, you know, Netflix has had movies that were big. Like, I mean, Bird Box was a big, like, flavor of the month type thing. But even that, right. I feel like, has died down since it came out.
Wasn't their big one Beasts of No Nation the first time, I think? Was that a Netflix movie?
That was a Netflix movie. That was kind of their first, attempt at getting some Oscar love.
Yeah.
And I don't think it did get any nominations. I mean, they tried. And I think people thought Idris Elba was going to get nominated. He didn't. But even then, like, they didn't campaign for that movie as hard as they did for Roma. They went out. They went all out. I mean, they spent, from what I understand, they spent way more on the campaign for Roma than any other studio spent on any, like the studio that produced Green Book, which I think was Universal. They spent like $5 million on their Oscar campaign, and Netflix spent like $50 million on their on their campaign for Roma.
That sort of, like, bothers me. Like, they know, like, obviously they're fighting an uphill battle. Like, it's annoying that they would have to spend 10 times as much as another studio. Just because they're Netflix.
I would agree with that, but also, like, Netflix overspends on everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't... Yeah, that's definitely a true point. But, it didn't work, is what I... Like, if they had spent that much and it worked, I would say, yeah, you probably didn't need it. But they spent that much and it didn't work.
Right, but they were also pushing a black and white foreign film, which was also kind of a tough sell for,
true.
You know, Best Picture at the Oscars, too. But what I think what I'm trying to say is, like, you know, if they spent, you know... any of that amount of time, you know, the time they spent campaigning for Roma, they could have also, you know, been like heavily advertising The Other Side of the Wind or Battle of Buster Scruggs or like all these other movies that like are great and interesting and cool. And I feel like they almost get like forgotten like a week or two after they're released, you know, because Netflix doesn't make people aware that they exist.
Yes. Yeah. They have a fire hose of content because they're trying to hide the fact that everyone else is taking the content off Netflix.
Right.
and their algorithm is the worst. So, yeah, it's very weird. It's interesting that that's the one they picked, right? I don't know if that – because it feels like Roma is like a prestige film, right?
Like right. It's an incredible like Oscar-winning director with Alex Caron and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it makes sense, but also at the same time, it's incredibly – insane for that to be the movie they picked.
Right. But I think kind of at the heart of this is that, like, you know, I think Spielberg is like in the wrong, and I hate saying that because Spielberg is like basically my childhood icon.
Yeah.
And you know, and honestly, I think if any, like, I think people were saying, like, look at this news story and be like, oh, Spielberg doesn't care about movies and that kind of thing. It's like, you're telling me Steven Spielberg
right.
doesn't care about movies? Like, if anybody cares about movies, like, it's Steven Spielberg. Like, you know, he cares about the sanctity of the theatrical experience, and I get that. Because if I can watch a movie in a theater, that's my preferred way of watching it. But obviously, that's not always the case for people. It's not always going to be the place that they can watch it, and Netflix has made movies more available to people than they ever have been in the past. But at the same time, Netflix has its own host of problems, and I could see why Spielberg wants this kind of theatrical window for movies. And I think if it encourages Netflix to give movies the same push they did for Roma, I think it would be better for Netflix as a brand on the whole, and better for the movies that they're promoting.
Yeah. I saw someone, I think, you know, in all this, the Twitter hot takes, about this, you know, say, when do you think was the last time Steven Spielberg had to pay for a movie and sat next to someone scrolling Instagram and there was a crying baby in the back row? Like, and I think that's like a valid critique about his point of view on that.
That's
like,
fair. I'm pretty sure he has his own private theater and he watches stuff on his own. Like, that's kind of
yeah, or like goes to press screenings and like yes. you know things like that. So yeah, I don't, like, you know, if I have to go pay $15 to see a movie and like I have the worst experience with it, I fuck you. I'm gonna watch this at home instead. and I think movies that are only released on Netflix or you know they managed to get this 1 week. Screening should still be considered.
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with you on there. But I think there are, I mean, I think we've already gone through it a lot, but there are so many different factors and things going into this conversation. And it's not something that is just as simple, like, yes or no, you are right, you are wrong type deal.
Right.
But in any case, I don't think, like, after all we've just said, like, I don't think this thing will take. I think ultimately the Academy has gotten a lot more progressive in that regard in recent years, even though there is like a contingent that is kind of like anti-Netflix. So I guess we'll see what happens. But I think this whole thing will kind of blow over. And who knows? Maybe Spielberg will make a Netflix movie in like 5 years and then it'll...
I mean, Scorsese did.
Scorsese did. Honestly, that's what was most surprising to me about this whole thing, is because Spielberg and Scorsese are like best buds.
Wow.
You know, like they go all the way back to like the late 60s. And so, you know, Scorsese's got his own Netflix movie coming out this year, The Irishman. And word is actually that Netflix is possibly planning like a full theatrical release for The Irishman when it comes out this year, which would be awesome. I would be like it's a new Martin Scorsese movie. I would like to see it in the theater if I can.
Yeah. If there's any movie that they would do that, it'd probably be that one, because I'm sure Scorsese made them.
I am sure he probably put that in his contract. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I believe they spent like a shitload of money on it, so I think they might actually want like a little bit of return on investment on that one, because it's literally like, I think it's their most expensive movie they've ever made. Like, it's like, you know, all the de-aging tech that's in Captain Marvel for Sam Jackson, that's on like every character in this movie, from what I understand.
Oh my god.
Because it spans like several like decades, and you know, it's got Robert De Niro and Al Pacino and Joe Pesci and Harvey Keitel, and they're all like they're playing all the versions of the characters like from all the different time periods. It's going to be an expensive movie.
Can't wait.
Yeah, I'm so excited for it. It's going to be great. But anyway, so that's the whole Spielberg Netflix debacle. I figured we should talk about it on the podcast because it was kind of the big film news that was revolving over the past few weeks. And now we can finally wrap up film news, Mike, and get into our discussions starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies.
place for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast, episode 100, by the way. We haven't mentioned that in a while, so I figured just throw that out there.
Yeah, just to remind everyone.
Just to remind everyone, this is the 100th episode of Film Bookcast, and we're not doing anything special about it. It's other than repeating the words, hey, it's episode 100, over and over again. All right, Mike, what do you got to discuss with us today?
I have a few things to discuss. First up, I want to talk about a new video game, Mike.
A Vidya game, you say?
A Vidya game, yes. Now that we have opened the floor officially for discussions to be any piece of media we've been consuming lately, even yes. though we've said that for 100 episodes, I'm going to talk about a video game called Apex Legends. This came out, I think, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago at this point. Okay. It is a free-to-play. It's the most marketing video game ever, with like a capital M. It okay. is a free-to-play character shooter battle royale game. So basically, somebody made a Fortnite Overwatch, and it's pretty great. You know, it, like, I think being free to play games gives it a lot of, like, okay, I can forgive that. It, yeah. It's, you know, for anyone not familiar with Battle Royale games, you know, everyone spawns in on this big island. You start with no guns, no loot, no anything, and it's just last man standing kind of thing. And Apex Legends is a blast. It's made by Respawn Studios, I think, which is the team that made Titanfall. Which is like it was a pretty big video yeah. game people might recognize.
I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just a big shooter. It's nothing like special. It's just fun with to get like load in with your friends. It has teams of three. So the whole thing. So you just like jump out of a ship with two of your friends and just like laugh as you just get like destroyed. Like it's just so silly. It's a lot of fun. And I've been playing it a lot, so I wanted to mention it because I didn't get to watch a ton because. We've just been texting, my, you know, me and my friends would be like, Apex, question mark? And then that's it. Like, and then I'm there and it's midnight and you're like, what yeah. happened? So yeah, that's Apex Legends. It's free. It's got microtransactions, of course. But at least it has that in a free game. So it's not that bad where you spent $60 and also they're like, give me more of your money.
Okay,
this
yeah.
time they're like, hey, we gave you this thing for free. Can we have some dollars, please? And you're like, all right, maybe. So that's Apex Legends. It's on nice. all the platforms. The other thing I wanted to mention or talk about is Critical Role, which is a Twitch show with nerdy-ass voice actors that play D&D from right. there, which I've talked about before.
Yes, you've mentioned the show a few times, and you haven't mentioned it in a long time, really.
Yeah, to be honest, I kind of haven't watched it in, like, I think a year.
Okay.
Yeah, they finished their first campaign, like, big, you know, level 20 or whatever they made it to. They started a fresh campaign. I watched a couple episodes. And I just don't have the, like, capacity anymore to watch 4 hours of a show every week. You know,
that's fair. That's
totally
fair.
4 hour D&D stream.
I remember you, when you were really, like, heavily into the show, you tried to say to me, like, hey, you should watch this. And I'd be like, oh, but they're 4 hour episodes? Like, it seems great.
Yeah, it's very daunting.
Yeah.
But they do have it in, like, audio podcast form now, which is pretty neat. So, like, you could, in theory, listen to it over a week now, which is cool.
Okay.
But they just launched the big news. They launched a Kickstarter recently, I think a week or two ago now, to fund a animated special originally. It was going to be a 22-minute episode. You know, they're all voice actors. They were going to yeah. do a 20, you know, that animated special with, I think it's Titmouse Animation, which does a bunch of Cartoon Network stuff. I don't remember which shows off the
yeah,
top of my head.
Yeah, I recognize their name. I don't know exactly what they do, but I recognize that.
Yeah. So they were going to do the animation. The cast was going to do the voices. And I think it's the fastest or second fastest Kickstarter to ever reach $1 million. It's
really?
Like 54 minutes or something like that. Insane. Like absolutely insane. And it's up to 7 million now. They started, the goal was 750,000 for a single episode. They're over 7 million now. They've added stretch goals to get to, basically a season. It's going to be like, it started as one episode. I think it's up to 9 or 8 or something like that.
Wow.
So I'm sure they're going to approach it's a 45-day campaign, so like I'm sure they're going to approach the most money ever on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And there's like been a lot of hot takes and controversy about it, which is very weird.
Really?
Yeah, because it is an all-white cast, and now everyone is talking about like, hey, you have all this money, why aren't you funding diverse stuff? I don't know, it's become like a whole thing. It's very... It's like hot takes, too hot to touch.
Okay, yeah.
So I think there's some interesting discussions going on there. I was a little like salty about it in some weird way.
Really?
Yeah. Like I'm glad that it's happening. I love that show and like what it was and what it is now, I guess. But there's a lot of like the critters, like the fans of Critical Role, as they're called, critters, are so like rabid. like every, and I don't mean that like as a slam on Critters. Everything Critical Role has ever done has immediately sold out. Like any piece of merch they've put out, any live show they've done, any art print, art book, comic book, like all this stuff they've done immediately sells out. So it feels kind of false to me in some way, where they're like, "Wow, I never expected this to happen." It's like you've been doing it for 4 years. You knew you were going to get all the money you ever wanted. And it's just like they weren't. No one is upfront about it, you know. Like,
okay,
it feels weird in some way. I don't know if that makes sense.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I'm surprised. Like, I am not part of that community at all. Right. But I know you have been, and I know like I have several Twitter followers that are just people that you're friends with that are also Critical Role fans.
Yeah,
and so you know, I assumed that it was like a pretty like it's a pretty niche thing. Like, it still is, but I guess just it's a very strong niche. But I guess that's how fan bases get, man. I mean, that's just like, it gets insane, very quick. But I am surprised at like I didn't realize that it was big enough to be like the fastest Kickstarter or whatever, to reach a million or second fastest or whatever. Like, remember when Mystery Science Theater 3000 did its Kickstarter?
Yes.
And it made its goals and it made it well past its goals. But like for a while we were like, oh, I don't know if it's going to make it. Like,
yeah.
And that was Mystery Science Theater. Like, that was like a beloved cult show that was coming back and everything. Like, we were really excited about it. And, you know, everything worked out in the end. But I remember when it was like it took like a couple of weeks for it to hit its goal.
Yeah.
For the first time. And then it, you know, eventually like kind of kicked into gear and it was able to make like 14 episodes instead of 6 or whatever. So I'm surprised like Critical Role seems to have more Kickstarter power than like Mystery Science Theater does, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It passed Mystery Science Theater was the highest funded TV or movie Kickstarter ever. Critical Role has passed that now.
Wow,
as the highest funded. Yeah, and it's just like it averages I think around like 30,000 viewers live every Thursday. Like, that's a lot of people watching D&D
to watch
show.
Something live. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And I don't know, you know, what they get in the YouTube or video on demand stuff, but like clearly there's a very large fan base for it. They sell out theaters like when they do live shows. It's insane.
Right.
So yeah, it just felt sort of weird for people to be like, oh my God, I never thought this would happen. It's like, come on, if you've been paying attention at all, you knew. Like, I just like, that was one of the things. They wanted one episode and they had the stretch goal already like created that, you know, if we get to 3 million, we'll have 4. And it's like, just start there. Like, you know what I mean? You knew you would get it because it was already a stretch goal you had planned. I don't know. It just feels weird. But that said, I'm still excited. I'm still going to watch it because it's going to be dope.
Okay. Fair. I feel like you've been like, very cynical this entire episode. I got to tell you.
Yeah.
Between this and between, like, I'm just going to torrent Disney Plus and, like, all this.
We live in a hellscape of late-stage capitalism, and I'm mad about it.
Fair enough.
So, fucking fund whatever you want, I guess. But it's cool. Like, it's, you know, I'm glad that people are excited about it. You know, it's something that I was very passionate about, and you know, I'm glad to see them being a success. That's awesome. That this is gonna like it could catapult this shit into like actual mainstream. Like, I could see Netflix picking this up or Amazon or whatever.
Yeah.
And apparently, they like put in the post that they had gone to studios and asked for offers and stuff, and they didn't like any of them. So it's cool that they're going to have creative control over their own thing.
Oh, nice.
That's cool. And the actual thing that I watched, my last discussion, I didn't know I would have that much to say about Critical Role, is Luther. Speaking of Idris Elba.
The thing they don't tell you about the drugs is that it makes you smell like a dog's ass. It's not very Keith Richards, is it? Not very rock and roll. Justin. I've never seen you in your uniform. You look like your own work experience.
Yeah, well, my good uniform got vomited on.
It's all very soul-destroying, isn't it? Actual police work.
Yes, Luther is a BBC crime drama, police procedural thing. And I know this is, like, a huge... People have been a big fan of Luther for a while.
Yeah, this show's been on the air since, like, 2011, I think.
So when I started watching it, I was like, yeah, okay, I know, like, I'm late to this party. And because of the way Netflix, you know, arranges things, it just has the release date for the most recent episodes, right? It says, like, Luther, 2015. So I was like, okay, let me see, you know, when this came out. And it's 2010. And I was like, oh, I did not know I was 9 years late to this party. And it's awesome. Idris Elba is just like 10 out of 10 sexy. He's just a badass, right? Like, come on.
Right.
And he's, you know, it's the classic detective with his own set of morals that, like, you know, we'll get a little dirty because it's what needs to be done kind of thing.
Right.
And it's fun. It starts out, you know, kind of like a Monster of the Week type situation. And then it slowly builds into this overarching story that continues for the rest of the series. And I think it's, 16 episodes total so far. There's four and two or something like that. There's four seasons up on Netflix.
There was a season that was just two episodes, you said?
Two episodes, yeah. Well, because it seemed like it ended. And the way BBC stuff works, it's like 2 or 3 years after the previous one, I think. Mm. It might have been like, oh, the fans want it, we'll make two more episodes. And I think there is one currently airing now on BBC, but it's not on BBC America yet and not up on Netflix or anything.
Yeah.
So there is a fifth season of it. So I'll check that out whenever it becomes available.
Okay. And you've watched the entire show up at that point then?
Yes.
You've watched all four seasons?
Yeah, I watched all four seasons of it. And it's awesome. Like I said, it's great. And they're hour long, you know, like 16 episodes or whatever. It's pretty manageable to watch an entire show
yeah.
in a week or two. So that's fun. And the cast is really great. Rose Leslie joins the cast eventually.
That's Ygritte from Game of Thrones, right?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, and it seems like there's a couple British character actors and stuff that I recognize, but I don't really know who they are. So, yeah, it's fun. It's good stuff.
Cool. All right, so that's Luther, and it's a pretty popular BBC show that Mike watched for the first time. You watched it via Netflix.
Yes.
Plus the Critical Role Kickstarter and whatever was the name of the game that you talked about before, I forget it.
Apex Legends.
Apex Legends was your other video game. And speaking of video games, I actually have a video game of my own to talk about in discussion.
What?
I know. You know, here's the thing. I have not been, like, a gamer in a long time, but in recent months, I have played, like, two video games, and suddenly it's like, oh, man, I gotta get back into games. Like, this
wow,
is cool.
Yeah. Welcome to the party.
But a few episodes ago, I talked about the Spider-Man PS4 game, finally getting to play that. That was awesome. And now I wanted to finally talk about a game that I have been anticipating for a very, very long time, and that is Kingdom Hearts 3. Now,
wow.
are you a Kingdom Hearts fan, Mike?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's fair. You're better off not being one. It is a sad, pathetic life that I have led.
No, you take that back.
Listen. Okay, so Kingdom Hearts. I consider the original Kingdom Hearts to be my favorite game of all time.
That's awesome.
It's a game that, you know, I played when it first came out in 2002. I think it was the first time I ever played a PS2. I played Kingdom Hearts. I was at my uncle's house, and like it was just this game that I saw, and it had Disney characters in the back, and I was like, this seems interesting. And I played it, and I just got like immediately hooked. And then like I played it the entire time I was at my uncle's house, which was like 6 hours straight. And then I had to go home and couldn't play it anymore. But then for Christmas that year, like I got a PS2, and I got 5 games along with it. One of them was Kingdom Hearts.
Nice.
And I was obsessed with it, and I couldn't beat it for years because I was 8 years old.
That's like the worst.
It's a surprisingly, like, the original Kingdom Hearts is a surprisingly difficult, not difficult, like when I play it now, like I could play it no problem. But also I've played it like a bunch of times at this point.
Yeah.
But like there's an actual, like, the strategy there, and it's a surprisingly mature game, I think, for that age. And I think, you know, the weird thing about Kingdom Hearts, and there are a lot of weird things about Kingdom Hearts, but, you know, when I first played Kingdom Hearts, I really hadn't played anything like it. It is this, you know, original story about, you know, this young kid named Sora who gets kind of sent on this hero's journey to find his friends. And he kind of ends up teaming up with these Disney characters, but also teaming up with these Final Fantasy characters. And I didn't know what Final Fantasy was at the time. So these were all, like, new characters to me that I learned about later on. But it was just such a unique blend of worlds and franchises. And, like, looking back on it, it's like, who even thought of that? Like, why was that even a thing? But it happened, and it was awesome. Kingdom Hearts 1 is an amazing game, and I was pretty much, like, a lifelong fan of the series from that point on, which meant that I dealt with, like, a lot of crap. Because, and I generally like most of the games in the Kingdom Hearts series, but here's the thing. Kingdom Hearts 2 came out in 2006, and now you have Kingdom Hearts 3, which came out in 2019. In that 14-year span, there were, you would think, oh, well, Kingdom Hearts 2 would lead right into Kingdom Hearts 3. But no, because there are like 5 or 6 different spin-offs that came out in that time, all of which were on different handheld consoles. And all of which were essential to your understanding of the overall story of these games. So you had, you know, the original Kingdom Hearts, and then you had Chain of Memories, which was like kind of an in-between game for Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2, and then you had Kingdom Hearts 2. And those three games tell a pretty complete story on their own. And then from there, you had Kingdom Hearts 358 over 2 days, which was a story about this character Roxas and what he's doing in between Chain of Memories and Kingdom Hearts 2. And then you have Birth by Sleep, which was a prequel that shows you these three characters that you did not know before 10 years before the events of Kingdom Hearts 1. And it kind of a lot of the stuff in Birth by Sleep comes into play in Kingdom Hearts 3. Like, a lot of that stuff in this game is set up from that game. And then you have Kingdom Hearts Coded, which is sort of like this weird side game that really doesn't matter that much, but it takes place right after Kingdom Hearts 2. And then you have Dreamed Up Distance, which leads right into Kingdom Hearts 3. And then also there was this cell phone game, Kingdom Hearts Unchained Key, which turns out is the most important game in the series if you're talking about the mythology, at least according to Kingdom Hearts 3. Because when I'm playing... And so anyway, Kingdom Hearts 3 was kind of billed as the conclusion to all of this, right? This was like the game that was supposed to end it all. It's what it was all building towards, and I was pretty excited about it because I love Kingdom Hearts, and I've invested a lot of time in the story, and I think overall Kingdom Hearts 3 is pretty good.
It's oh man, that's the worst ever.
I don't hate it. I think there's a lot of stuff that's frustrating, but it's frustrating in the way that Kingdom Hearts is often frustrating. So like I was used to it, but it really felt like, and I mean, this isn't the really main problem with the game, but this was a big thing, which was that it felt like Disney had a lot more influence on this game than they had in previous games. Because in other games, you know, you have these Disney worlds that you're going through, but usually, like, every once in a while, you'll get one where it's like, okay, now we're in this Disney world, and we're just playing the plot of this Disney movie, and then we're leaving. But usually the best Kingdom Hearts games are the ones that, like, actually integrate the story and the characters of that Disney world into the overall plot of the game. You know, and the original Kingdom Hearts does that the best, I think. It's great at it. But Kingdom Hearts 3, I think if you cut out every single Disney world in this game, I don't think you would lose any story. Like, any of the overall story. And that's the thing. It's a game that, like, you know, it really... If you cut out the first 20 hours and you just played, like, the last seven... Like, you would still pretty much get it. So it feels like it's a game that's, like... It doesn't really have as much of a story as you would want it to. Which is weird, because there's so many different story threads that are coming together in this thing.
Right.
But it really kind of just acts as, like, an extended epilogue for all these games. And kind of just, like, reverses the endings of a lot of these games. Because a lot of these games end in very downer endings, and you want to see, like, all these characters be happy. But, you know, for the most part, like, the gameplay is a lot of fun. The gameplay is pretty much the same as it's always been, but they do some different things. There's a lot of, like, really cool different, like, different things you can do with the Keyblade and stuff like that that you hadn't really been able to do in other games, and that's cool. And the world building is a lot of fun. I think the actual, like, playability of the Disney worlds and the design, like, they're really cool. Especially, I mean, I really enjoy it. You start off in the Hercules world, which has been established in a lot of the Kingdom Hearts games up to this point. It's been in almost every one of them. But this one really, like, expands it. You're going through the whole city. You're on Mount Olympus, and it's, like, it just feels bigger. And every single world does feel like its own distinctive thing. And kind of like a different take on different video game things. So like the Big Hero 6 world plays like this kind of sandbox game and that kind of thing.
Right.
And that's pretty cool. But the overall experience of playing it is like, it feels like you're killing time for a long time. And then you get to the conclusion stuff, and a lot of the conclusion stuff works, and then a lot of it just like is either confusing or it doesn't feel earned because it wasn't like kind of parceled out well throughout the entire game. And also a lot of it is teasing for another game. It's a lot of like setting up things for probably like 10 different spinoffs that are in the works. And a lot of it hinges on your knowledge of this fucking Kingdom Hearts cell phone game, which no one played. Why would they hinged it all on that? It's ridiculous. And luckily, I played that cell phone game for a little bit, just to, like, download it and check it out, and I ended up, like, not playing that much of it, because it was, like, I think you would have to play it for, like, hundreds of hours in order to actually complete the game. It's one of those kind of things.
Yeah.
But they did release, like, a one-hour video, like a one-hour kind of mini-movie, that sort of deals with the mythology of that cell phone game, and it doesn't do everything. Like, there's still stuff in Kingdom Hearts 3 that doesn't make sense, even though I watched that mini-movie. But it does introduce some characters that do kind of pop up later on and that kind of thing. So it does, that did help. But that's the thing. It feels like there's so much homework just to get like basic stuff that happens in Kingdom Hearts 3. And I would imagine if you had only played Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2 and you jumped into Kingdom Hearts 3, I feel like you would be completely lost. I know people who did that and they were completely lost.
Jesus.
But overall, like, I enjoyed the game. It's a pretty fun time, and I think it's an okay conclusion to this chapter of the story. And the ending is weird. It's different than I thought it would be. I think there was a lot to be left to interpretation. Like, I didn't really understand what was happening, and then I talked to somebody else who had played the game, and he was like, "Yeah, so I think this is what happened," and like, "Yeah, I guess that is what happened, but that doesn't seem right." it's a lot of going back and forth. It's very frustrating in some cases, but it's also, you know, there's a lot of fun there. There's a lot of fun callbacks to the other games, and it does feel like it's bringing a lot of stuff together. It just feels like it's incomplete in some way, which is a shame because they had to work on this game for 14 years.
Wow.
You know?
There's nothing more disappointing than waiting 14 years for the conclusion of a story and only being whelmed by it.
I think that's a good way to put it. Again, I don't dislike it, and I'm not like entirely disappointed. I think I had a decent time with it. Apparently they're going to release some DLC at some point. By the way, there's no Final Fantasy characters in this game. And I was very upset about it.
That's bizarre.
It's so weird because they were such a huge part of the story in Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2. And in this game, they are not. They're not even there. It's very bizarre.
I was going to say, but how about that Pirates of the Uncanny Valley Caribbean world, though?
Yeah, Pirates of the Caribbean is back in this game. They were in Kingdom Hearts 2 also.
Oh, okay.
Yes, so it's kind of the same. But it is weird because, yeah, it is like the one world that's based on a live-action movie, and so they all kind of like look like their live-action counterparts, where everybody else is like, hey, we're Donald Duck and Goofy, and we're hanging out in fucking Pirates of the Caribbean world. It's weird. It's a weird series of games, man. It's like,
yeah.
I'm not going to go through the entire timeline of the Kingdom Hearts games for you right now, because that would take 10 hours. but I could, and your brain would be destroyed by the end of it. It's such an overly complex series for what is essentially like a game for children. Like, they're right. Disney games. They're Disney games. But yeah. Anyway, that's Kingdom Hearts 3. And I enjoyed it, and I think at some point I would like to do like a whole series replay of the Kingdom Hearts games where I play all of them all over again, just to, like, experience that story in full, and then get upset when I realize again that I didn't experience the story in full because Kingdom Hearts 3 sets up things that will happen later. But anyway, Kingdom Hearts 3, I think, is a solid conclusion of the series. There's good stuff in there, and then there's a lot of not great stuff in there too. But and I can't really go into that without going into spoilers. And A, I know you don't care about them because you don't play the game. And B, I'm not going to spoil the game for anybody who hasn't played it. So that's Kingdom Hearts 3. And then I have a couple other things in my discussions here, Mike. I wanted to kind of give a shout out to this movie that I saw that I've been trying to see for a while. It came out in 2014. Called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. And have you heard of this movie, Mike?
I have heard of it. I haven't seen it. I think it's available on Shudder also.
Is it? Okay.
I believe so.
I remember it came out in theaters and I heard good things and I wanted to see it. And then I think it hit Netflix and it was in my queue for like a year and I didn't watch it and then it disappeared. But this is a movie directed by Anna Lily Amirpour. It's her first movie. And she directed another movie a couple years later, which I also wanted to see and haven't yet, called The Bad Batch. Which starred Jason Momoa and Jim Carrey and Keanu Reeves, and it's supposed to be kind of insane. But this is a black and white Iranian vampire Western.
And wow.
This movie rocks. It's so good. It's very tense. It's very atmospheric. It's like a sort of horror movie, but like sort of a love story at the same time. And it just had me hooked for its whole runtime. Like, I was lucky enough to be able to see it in a theater last weekend, the Roxy, a theater in Missoula, Montana, which I mention every episode on this podcast.
You can just say the Roxy.
I know, but for first time listeners, they don't know, man.
It's our 100th episode.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But it's very good. I was pretty happy with this movie. I think if you're into that kind of art house horror, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, definitely something to check out. Also wanted to mention that Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt dropped its final 6 episodes, I think at the end of January, and I finished them, and it's very good. It's a very good show, and I'm going to miss it. And it's weird. It's another one where it feels like, you know, they kind of just dropped with very little fanfare on Netflix's part. Like, they kind of just like, oh, and here's the last 6 episodes of Kimmy Schmidt. And now let's move on to the next 100 things that we have to that we have to drop on you. But this was a great show. Did you ever watch Kimmy Schmidt?
No. You know, I kind of missed the boat on it, and then I just never got around to it.
Okay. Were you a 30 Rock fan?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, if you like 30 Rock, you're going to like Kimmy Schmidt. It's basically the same. It's the same style of humor, and it's a lot of the same cast members are in the show, and it's, you know, the same, it's literally, it's even the same, like, fucking score. It's like, literally everybody who's involved in 30 Rock is involved with Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. I mean, Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, and Ellie Kemper was amazing in the lead role. Jane Krakowski, Titus Burgess, just a very, Carol Kane also, just amazing on the show. And the last six episodes, I think, are a good conclusion to the series. It's a good send-off. I think it does the kind of 30 Rock thing where, like, 30 Rock had a way more emotional and sentimental finale than was fitting for that show. But at the same time, like, it worked for that finale. It was a weird balancing act that 30 Rock struck, and I think Kimmy Schmidt pretty much strikes it as well. So there is that. So Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, the final six episodes, which were in its fourth season, dropped, and they are very good. And I know Netflix actually has the last, like, eight episodes of Arrested Development dropping, like, next week, too. So I am looking forward to that as well. But and finally, got one last thing in my discussions here, Mike, and it's a movie that I've seen many times, but I wanted to give it a shout-out just because I watched it on my plane ride back to Missoula this past weekend. I flew out to New York this past weekend for a whirlwind trip to go see Elton John live in concert, which, by the way, was awesome.
Yeah, totes worth, I yes. assume.
Yeah, it was very, very cool. And actually, during Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, he plays the clip from Kingsman 2 where he's fighting, and it's great. just wanted to throw that out there because that's awesome. Anyway, on my way back to Missoula, you know, I was on, Delta Airlines, and I was kind of, in a state of, like, sort of unconsciousness, but, like, I woke up, and I couldn't get back to sleep, and I was like, all right, I'll watch one of these in-flight movies that I have access to through Delta. But I didn't really want, like, I was thinking about, like, maybe I should watch some that I haven't seen before, but I was, like, you know, too tired to do that, you know? I was too tired to give something, like, my full attention, but then I saw they had Disney's Hercules on... on the thing, and I was like, you know what? It's Hercules time, baby.
Are you all right, Miss?
Megara. My friends call me Meg. At least they would if I had any friends. So, did they give you a name along with all those rippling pectorals? Are you always this articulate?
Hercules. My my name is Hercules.
I think I prefer Wonder Boy.
So, how'd you get mixed up with the...
Pinhead with hooves? Well, you know how men are. They think no means yes, and get lost means take me, I'm yours. Don't worry, Shorty here can explain it to you later. Well, thanks for everything, Herc. It's been a real slice.
Wait, can we give you a ride?
I don't think your Pinto likes me very much.
Pegasus? Oh, don't be silly. He'd be more than happy to... Ow.
I'll be all right. I'm a big, tough girl. I tie my own sandals and everything.
And Hercules... I don't know about you. Hercules was always, like, one of my favorite of the Disney animation movies from when I was a kid. That came out in, like, 97. So I was, like, four when that movie came out. So maybe it just hit me at the right time or whatever.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, movies like The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, they got more of the critical acclaim, and, like, I feel like they're more beloved now. But Hercules, man, that was the shit. I love
that.
That's
the gospel truth.
That is the gospel truth. But I love Hercules, and I think it still holds up. It's great. I mean, it's got, like, this very slapstick quality to it that I really enjoyed in the movie. And it sort of feels like it kind of goes into pop culture reference territory a little. Like, it almost starts to, like, foreshadow the stuff that, like, DreamWorks would be doing in the 2000s with, like, Shrek and Shark Tale and stuff, where it's, like, doing a lot of pop culture references. But I feel like in Hercules, they feel more organic, and they're also, like, kind of catering those pop culture references to that kind of ancient Greek mythology time. You see, you know, like, Air Jordans become Air Herps and that kind of thing. But, like, but to me, they were funny. And also, just, I really, like, I was a big Greek mythology kid. And so, like, the way that movie goes, like it's a very surface view of it, but, like, there's a lot of, like, jokes that kids aren't going to get, like, referencing Greek mythology and things like that. There's one Oedipus joke that's amazing.
Wow.
In Hercules, I don't know if you remember that, but he's talking to Meg, and he's like, yeah, and that play, that Oedipus thing, man, I thought I had problems. And he keeps going. It's great. Also, I think Meg in this movie is, like, my favorite Disney heroine ever. She's amazing. Like, she's just a really, like, cool and strong female character. I think her song, I Won't Say I'm in Love, is one of the best songs that Disney ever did. It's a great movie. Hercules. It's awesome. If you haven't seen it in a while, it holds up. So
yeah. Does James Spader voice Hades?
I can't remember. It's James Woods. James Woods.
James Woods.
Hades.
Ah, right.
Yes.
Woof.
Who? Yeah.
Moving on.
I mean, James Woods, bad, like, you know, not a great guy now, but he was very good as Hades. Just throwing that out there. And weirdly, he still plays Hades in the Kingdom Hearts games, actually.
That's not a great look.
It's a little weird. It's a little weird. But anyway, yeah, that is Hercules, and it's available to watch. It will be available to watch on Disney Plus, I'm guessing.
Imagine that's like the one movie they don't have.
Man, that would be unfortunate. For sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So Hercules, it's awesome. Go watch it if you haven't. And if you have, go watch it again. It's great. And now I think we can finally move on, Mike, into our featured review of Captain Marvel.
Your life began the day it nearly ended. We found you. With no memory, we made you one of us. So you could live longer, stronger, superior. You were reborn.
I keep having these memories. Something in my past is the key to all of this.
You know how to fly this thing?
We'll see.
That's a yes or no question.
Yes.
All right, that was from the trailer for Captain Marvel, the new movie written by Anna Boden, Ryan Fleck, and Geneva Robertson-Dwarrett, and directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. It stars Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, Ben Mendelsohn, Lashana Lynch, Jude Law, Clark Gregg, Annette Bening, Gemma Chan, Jaimin Hunsu, and Lee Pace, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Captain Marvel reads: Carol Danvers becomes one of the universe's most powerful heroes when Earth is caught in the middle of a galactic war between two alien races. Now, Mike, obviously, we're both pretty big Marvel fans here. I think over the course of 100 episodes of Film Bookcast, I think anybody who has listened in could probably piece that together. I think that's safe to say, right?
Yes, I would agree.
Now, how hyped were you for Captain Marvel? Like, on a scale of, like, 1 to 10, like, were you excited about this movie?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably, like, around a 7-8 there. What about you?
Yeah, I was pretty hyped for Captain Marvel, too. I mean, I read, I have read a few comics featuring the character, and I have liked her in the comics. And I love me some Brie Larson, so I was excited to see her make her debut in the Marvel Universe. Plus, I was excited to see Sam Jackson get a larger role in this one than he really has in the past. And I was pretty eager to explore some of the cosmic MCU with Marvel's first headlining female superhero, which is also kind of the big thing about this movie.
Yes.
I mean, there was Ant-Man and the Wasp, so she was in the title of the movie, but this is like the first solo Marvel female venture.
Right.
But yeah, so that was kind of a big deal. And I mean, it was sort of a thing where it's like, you know, people have been asking Marvel to do this for a while, right? People have been like requesting a Black Widow movie for a very long time. And it seems like we're actually going to get that at some point in the near future. But they ultimately went with Captain Marvel, and it took them 21 movies to get there. But they finally got there, and that's definitely a good thing for representation and all that kind of stuff. And obviously, it worked out for them. I mean, as we mentioned before, Captain Marvel made bank this weekend.
Yeah.
Way more than I think anybody expected it to, which is awesome. Now, we don't really have to talk about what we think of all the other Marvel movies, because we already, like, we've established we're fans of the franchise in general. If not, like, I'm sure there's, like, odd movies here and there that maybe we're not the biggest fans of, but, like, overall, it's good stuff. It's good stuff overall.
Yes.
So, Mike, let's hear your thoughts. What did you think of Captain Marvel?
I had a really fun time with Captain Marvel. I think, you know, I saw some criticism of it being, you know, just like a standard rote superhero origin story kind of thing. And it definitely, like, hits all those beats, but I think it is, you know, it has the Marvel charm to it. So, like, I'm kind of, like, along for the ride and having fun and enjoying myself, even though it is doing all that stuff. And I think it is still kind of important to have that, like, you know, the first female-led Marvel superhero film, like, deserves a really good origin story and deserves that kind of thing. Because I think it is, it hits all those beats well, I guess is what I'm saying, for being an origin story. It doesn't feel boring. You know, it's goofy, it's fun. It manages to avoid the whole joke of being that it's set in 1995, which a lot of these, like, kind of movies, nostalgia movies can fall into, right? Where it's like, oh my God, payphones is like the whole movie. And it doesn't do that. Like, it does some of it. It has a couple beats.
I was going to say, there's definitely bits where it's like, hey, Radio Shack, that doesn't exist anymore. But like,
yeah, yeah. But it's not like, not every joke is that. What can happen with these sorts of movies. I think Brie Larson does a really good job. I think Carol Danvers is the fucking dopest, is going to be the fucking dopest.
Right.
And, like, Samuel L. Jackson in, like, a Buddy Road movie. Like, I'm in. Like, that's great. It's so much fun. I don't know if this falls into my, like, top five. You know, it's probably in top 10. So, like, you know, top half of the Marvel MCU movies. I don't know exactly where. I haven't, like, sat down and ranked all of them personally.
Yeah.
But it's still really good. And I just, like, you know, had a blast. And I'm glad that we're here. It's clear, like, you know, we're going to have a new face of the Marvel movies, I think.
Yes.
You know, knowing where certain actors' contracts and stuff have ended. And I'm, like, down with that. I think it's going to be a bright future for Phase 4 or whatever the hell we're on.
Right, yeah. I mean, I did see, I think it was David Sims who tweeted out that Captain Marvel kind of officially positions, like, the new Marvel universe, like, the new faces of the universe to be Doctor Strange, Black Panther, and Captain Marvel as basically the new Tony Stark, Thor, Captain America kind of thing. Like, that kind of whole dichotomy. Which I think is definitely interesting. So before I get into what I think of the movie, I just let me say, ahead of everything else, I enjoyed it, okay? I enjoyed the movie.
Easy, careful, Mike, careful.
I enjoyed the movie on a baseline level. I had fun with it. But, like, maybe it's just that we've been spoiled over the last year of superhero movies with stuff like Ragnarok and Black Panther and Infinity War and Spider-Verse. But, like, I enjoyed it, okay?
Uh-huh.
I enjoyed Captain Marvel, but I did feel a little bit let down after all that. Like, it's fun. Like, it's a fine time. And I think knowing more about the direction that this movie heads, I might enjoy it a little more the second time I watch it, which I'm definitely going to do. Because now that I've seen Captain Marvel, I plan on doing a full MCU rewatch before Endgame comes out. That's the plan. So, like, and I'm sure Captain Marvel will still be in theaters by the time Endgame comes out. So,
yeah. So that should be 3 weeks away.
Exactly. Well, like 6 weeks, but still.
Yeah.
But like, okay. So here's the thing. I think there are parts of this movie that work, and the stuff that works really works. I think all the performers are doing great stuff, especially Brie Larson. I think she's great as Captain Marvel, and Ben Mendelsohn. I think he's incredible in this movie as Talos. I think the de-aging tech on Sam Jackson has been, like, perfected over the course of several movies, and it looks insane. How good is I don't know how you felt about that, but I thought, like, he looked amazing.
I honestly didn't think that he was de-aged. I was like, that's just what Sam Jackson looks like. And it's very weird.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what he looked like in the 90s.
And but, like, and it tricked me into thinking this is what he looks like. I didn't even once consider the fact that he was de-aged.
Exactly. I mean. And that's how fucking seamless it is. It's terrifying, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, how good that stuff looks. And they also have de-aging stuff in Clark Gregg as well. And that, like, looks
that
a little iffier.
Noticed.
Yeah, that one you notice. Not that it looks, I don't think it looks bad on Clark Gregg. It's just like, maybe it's just because, you know, like, Clark Gregg's character is dead in these movies.
I think it was just that he doesn't look old now. So it was like, why? Like, it just was enough for him to look too young, if that makes sense.
Yes. You know? Yeah. But getting off of that stuff, I think the story I think takes some turns that I did not expect, and I thought they were welcome turns. I thought they were, like, actually, like, really interesting reveals that happened throughout this movie. And I think it's got this very quiet message of female empowerment, like, under the surface of it. I don't think this movie is as in your face about it being feminist as something like Wonder Woman, right? Where I think it's much more overt in that movie, but it's recognizably there in Captain Marvel, and I actually find it, like, more interesting in this one. Some of the stuff that it's saying.
Yeah.
So my issues really come from, like, the actual filmmaking crafts of the movie. Like, I've seen complaints before about, like, Marvel's house style, mm-hmm. and I've made a few of those complaints myself. But, like, there are filmmakers who can make that their own and do something interesting with it, like with Taika Waititi did with Ragnarok or Ryan Coogler did with Black Panther. And this one doesn't really do that. I mean, I think it is at times, like, a very ugly looking movie. I think every once in a while you get a very cool, like, carefully composed shot. But for the most part, like, you're dealing with a very desaturated color palette and very flat lighting throughout most of the movie. And I think it ultimately, like these movies are based on characters that you have, that have, like, they're almost entirely visual, right? Like, they're characters that you have to have, like, some kind of visual connection to, because they're based on a visual medium, comic books, right? And they're based on these characters with these, like, superpowers that you're supposed to be able to see. And, like, you know, when you have something like Spider-Verse come out, like, 3 months ago, and then you have this, which just looks very flat, I can't help but feel like a little bit of a disconnect there. And I would say that the action sequences, for the most part, were pretty flat. Like, they like, none of them really worked for me, you know. And Marvel is famous for sort of, like, outsourcing a lot of their action to, like, a pre-viz team. And it's up to the filmmaker to really figure out, like, how involved in that process they want to be. And again, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I don't think it works here. I think the action sequences just, like, they don't work. And, you know, I wanted them to work so badly, because I was loving Brie Larson, and I think she deserved, like, an awesome action scene, like, especially once she gets, like, her, like, once she's, like, really figuring out her powers, like,
right.
And I think there's an attempt at that with a certain scene towards the end, and we'll talk about that later, but it just, it feels, I don't know, everything about this movie feels, like, redundant of other movies, except for the fact that you have Brie Larson as Captain Marvel, right? And she's, like, the movie rests on her shoulders, and she carries it admirably. She's great. Like, everything that I like about this movie, I can tie back to Brie Larson. She's great. I can't wait to watch this character in Endgame and in 50 other movies as the as time goes on.
Yes. Yeah, I definitely did notice that. There's a lot of action sequences where, unfortunately, to call back to our Complete Works, most recent episode, I thought of Outcast, the Nicolas Cage movie, where it's just a lot of the fighting, just because that was the movie I watched right before this.
Yes.
A lot of the action sequences and fighting is edited to a point where you can't really see what's happening. And that's really unfortunate, because I think it could have been dope. I think Captain Marvel's powers are the dopest. And
yes.
Like, I would love to see that fully realized visually. Hopefully, I'm sure we will see it in Endgame, and I hope it's a lot better. And I'm sure it will be.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Russos have proven pretty good at shooting that kind of superhero action stuff.
Yeah.
So I am looking forward to seeing how Captain Marvel factors into that movie, at least if only for that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and there are some scenes, too. I agree with you. I mean, I did see this in 3D, so I don't know if it's because of that, where, you know, you're looking through dark glasses, where a lot of it was, like, especially in the beginning and one, the first, like, action set piece on that, like, on, I forget what the planet name is, but we'll talk about it in spoilers, where I was like, I hope I can't see what's happening. I don't know.
What's going. I mean, I saw it in 2D and I had that same feeling, so.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know the filmography of these two filmmakers that directed it, so maybe it's just kind of like are they new to filmmakers?
No, well, they're Annabodin and Ryan Fleck, and they're an indie filmmaking duo, and they've been making films for a while. I mean, they've made some very good movies, like Half Nelson with Ryan Gosling, and they made
Ryan Reynolds.
With Ryan Reynolds, which would be a very different movie.
Yes.
But they also made It's Kind of a Funny Story, which is honestly one of my favorite movies. I love that movie.
Wow.
So that's kind of their wheelhouse. They've made, like, very small scale type stuff, and it was kind of a surprise that they got hired for this movie.
Yeah, I do remember talking about that, actually, on Film News.
And I think when the movie is focused on, like, just the characters, like, and kind of, like, in, like, one location and, like, just kind of doing, like, small-scale things, I think that's where those, their filmmaking talents really shine.
Yeah.
But it's, whenever it is the action stuff, like, in the cosmic stuff or whatever, I feel like a lot of that, it probably fell to the pre-viz team or whatever, and it just didn't, like, it doesn't land, you know?
Yeah, no, I get it. I think I had enough fun and was just, like, jazzed enough to kind of forgive it for that. But yeah, I'm be interested to watch it. I'm definitely going to see it again, I'm sure. So I'll be interested to watch it a second time and be kind of, like, more conscious of it. Because that usually happens to me a lot of times. Like, the first time I see something, favorite guest friend of the show, Vin Craig, says that he normally likes most movies anyway. And I kind of fall into that, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
Or just like, yeah, I enjoy this. And I'm willing to forgive some stuff. That said, I don't think the lack of action, or not lack of action, the mishandling of the action sequences would ever be enough to make me not like this movie, right? Like, you prefaced it with saying that, like, you know, you enjoyed this movie, it's fine, it's good.
Yeah.
And I think I would end up probably in the same area.
Yeah, because, I mean, that is also the thing. I feel like, you know, people have criticized Marvel for the action in the past, but I feel like there's... I would say there's a lot of really good Marvel action set pieces. There are some lousy ones. I think there are, like, movies that don't... I personally think Spider-Man Homecoming is a movie that doesn't have a ton of great action sequences in it either. And I know people would disagree with me on that one. I do like the DC sequence, but, like, everything else doesn't really work. And I think this movie kind of falls into the same boat. But when you have something like the Civil War, like, airport fight, right? Like,
yeah.
That's a great sequence. Or, like, the big finale in Thor Ragnarok, or the one-take scene in Black Panther and stuff. Like, there's a lot of really cool stuff in these Marvel movies. And I think a lot of them have done a better job at action sequences than people have given them credit for. Captain Marvel just doesn't does not measure up for me, I guess. Which was weird. It was weird to watch it and being like, I feel like I should be wowed by a lot of the things that are happening here. And I just wasn't. But by the way, just as a side note, did you know, I just found this out today, that the second unit directors of Captain America Civil War were Chad Stahelski and David Leitch, the guys who made John Wick.
What? No wonder the elevator fight is so dope.
That's actually Winter Soldier, but...
Oh, wait, what'd you say?
Civil War. Oh. Apparently.
That's dope. Although,
maybe they worked on Winter Soldier, too. I don't know.
I have no idea.
It wouldn't surprise me, because probably my favorite action sequences in the entire franchise are from Winter Soldier, actually. But anyway, yeah. So as far as the action goes, it kind of left me a little bit underwhelmed. And I do think this movie falls victim to the trap that a lot of prequels fall into, which is the realm of answering questions that nobody was asking. And I think that it does answer questions that some people were asking, but they were stuff that, like, I didn't care about that much, and, like, I feel like they might just be better left unexplained. But I think I can't really get into any of that until we get to spoilers.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, though, because I was surprised by how unbeholden to continuity I felt the movie was.
Really?
I feel like it definitely, like, has that weight in it. Like, you need to explain things and set some stuff up for other movies. But I felt like a lot of it wasn't, or maybe I just didn't notice it. I don't know. Like, it just wasn't, in my mind, like, very concerned about explaining where everything is or how we got here. And, like, it definitely does a lot of it, I guess. But yeah, I don't know. That's interesting. We'll talk about it in spoilers.
Okay. Yeah. Fair. I felt like, you know, it's obviously Captain Marvel origin story, and her stuff is mostly disconnected from everything else that's happened so far. But it's also kind of a Nick Fury origin story, and you get like a lot of stuff about, I guess I shouldn't really go into spoiler. Like, I'm veering into spoiler territory as it is. So we'll save it. But, yeah. but there was stuff there that I was like, I don't know if I needed this. Like, I just didn't,
that's fair.
Yeah, but like I said, you know, Brie Larson, great in the movie. She carries it. I think what I like about Carol Danvers in this movie, I think she feels like a perfect blend between like the righteous morality of Steve Rogers and like the snarky attitude of Tony Stark. And you kind of have both of those character traits coming together, but she also feels like distinctly her own person. And it's a role I can only see her getting like better and better in as she goes on. You know, like I liked her in this movie, but it sort of felt like in Captain America: The First Avenger. You know, I liked Chris Evans as Captain America in that movie. Like, he was fine. But I didn't really feel like he became, like, my Captain America until, like, the Avengers hit. And then he was, like, suddenly, like, the leader of the team, and, like, it was really cool. And then when Winter Soldier hit, I was like, he's my favorite. He's the best. and I feel like that'll happen with Brie Larson. I think she's very good in this movie. And I'm guessing she'll probably be really good in Endgame. And by the time Captain Marvel 2 hits, it's going to be like, holy shit, she's the best one in this entire franchise. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that what you say, how'd you describe it? The snarky whatever of Iron Man?
The snarky attitude. Like the
snarky kind of attitude.
With the quips and the one-liners and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I did notice that, but it landed for me just like an unyielding self-confidence. Like that she's like, yeah, I'm better than all of you. But not in the like, I'm a rich playboy way. Just like, I am better than all of you. Like, and just like, full stop. and that's, I don't know, that's kind of cool. I'm excited to see that get expanded. I did see some like criticisms or, you know, like fucking dumb angry Reddit comments or like, she's a flat, flat character and like all this dumb stuff.
Yeah.
And like, yes, definitely. But it's a lot of like just repressed, like her character trait in this movie is that everything is repressed. Right.
Right.
And I'm excited to see that broadened, I guess, later movies.
And I think that is also the thing. It feels like maybe we started the story too early. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I feel you're forcing Brie Larson to have amnesia for the majority of the movie. And that limits what she can do with the character for the majority of the movie, because she is I get the criticism that she's flat in the role because like, really she doesn't have that much to emote for most for most of the movie. And when she finally kind of breaks out of that towards the end, again, veering into spoiler territory, but I figure people assume like, oh, well, she'll be Captain Marvel by the end of the movie. But by the end, my main thought was like, I think the movie I really wanted to see this time around was whatever Captain Marvel 2 was going to be. I feel like once she's like fully formed as a character, like that's the movie we're going to get with Captain Marvel 2.
Yeah. It amplifies that feeling because it's the 21st movie, right? We've already had all this build up for all these other characters going through this arc or have completed this arc. 20 movies ago, or throughout 20 movies, and that we get a new one, and like, you know, it's a new character being introduced. We have to start here in some you know, some fashion. But it feels, in comparison to other movies, like you said, we're a little too early in the character arc, I think.
Right. That's fair. I mean, when was the last time we had an origin story movie? I feel like it was Doctor Strange, I feel like, maybe.
Yeah.
Before that was, I guess, Ant-Man. But I think with those movies, like, you know, I honestly, like, as far as the story goes, I think this one does arguably more interesting things than either of them. But those movies are much more visually dynamic than this one is. And so you kind of have that kind of trade-off where, like, I like a lot of the stuff that this movie does in terms of, like, its plot and its characters. But Doctor Strange also has some fucking dope-ass psychedelic sequences. And, like, Ant-Man has those shrinking sequences where it really plays around with scale and stuff. And, like, this movie had the potential to have some, like, really crazy cosmic space stuff. Right, and you get, like, a taste of that, but I feel like you don't get nearly as much of it as you would want from a movie like this.
I agree with you. It kind of toes the line. I feel like I would have had much more fun if we had gone balls out on both, in both categories. Like, if we had gone full cosmic craziness and had this awesome story. But I still had fun. Like, I still enjoyed it a lot. And I'm glad to see the character arc that we do get, and I'm excited to see the insanity that is going to be Endgame and also whatever Captain Marvel team holds in store.
Right, exactly. I did want to say also, I when I was watching it, I couldn't help but feel like this movie's placement in the Marvel Universe feels like a weird one, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm curious how I might have reacted to this movie if it came out before Infinity War did, you know? Like, if this movie came out, like, let's say the schedule got switched around, and instead of getting Spider-Man Homecoming, we got Black Panther and Captain Marvel before Infinity War, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you could probably still do Infinity War without having Homecoming, like... Realistically, because you do introduce Spider-Man in Civil War.
Right.
So you could still have Spider-Man in Infinity War, and it might not have as much emotional resonance when he fades away because you don't get his relationship with Iron Man in Homecoming, but, like, it would still be kind of there. You would still get it, or you could change stuff around, whatever. But let's say Captain Marvel and Black Panther came out before Infinity War did, but Captain Marvel did not show up in Infinity War, right?
Right.
And then at the very end of Infinity War, you have that post-credit scene where Nick Fury pages Captain Marvel, and I think that post-credit scene would actually mean a lot more. Because you would have seen Captain Marvel at that point.
Right.
Because as is, you see that post-credit scene, and, like, people who read comics know that logo, and they're like, holy shit, it's Captain Marvel! And then the other 90% of the audience is like, wonder what that's about.
Well, let me Google what that is.
Exactly. So if you had Captain Marvel come out, and then as soon as, you know, Nick Fury pulls out that pager in the post-credit scene, it would have been like, oh my god! It's the pager from the end of Captain Marvel! He's about to pager! And then it cuts to black. And then you don't have Captain Marvel show up until Endgame, so then you have, like, two movies worth of build-up where it's like, oh, Captain Marvel is going to start some shit.
Right.
And I feel like, as it is now, it's like, all right, Infinity War came out, and then it ended with Nick Fury sending out that page, and then, okay, now we got to put the narrative on pause so we can introduce this character.
Explain what he just did.
Explain all of that. So now we can unpause and come back to Endgame in 6 weeks. So it feels like, it's weird. It's like we're doing, like, a quick 2-hour backstory on a character who will probably play a key supporting role in Endgame. I described it as it's the Hugo Stiglitz scene in Inglourious Bastards, but spread out.
Yes.
Spread out to an entire, like, massive scale.
It's the machete order of the Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
You watch the Luke, I am your father scene, and then we flash back to explain that whole thing.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Come back to the end. And, like, I'm down. Like, yeah, I'm excited for it.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for it, too. I just feel like the placement of this movie feels weird because of that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's something you not necessarily, you can't really help necessarily. Like, they would have had to put this movie into production a year earlier, and that kind of thing. And who knows if they would have cast Brie Larson if that was the case and all that stuff. So I'm glad we got the movie we got, and I'm glad Brie Larson is cast Captain Marvel because she's great at it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she'll crush it in Endgame, but just, I think it's an interesting what if scenario, much like those what if scenarios that will be on Disney Plus in the near future.
Disney, pay us. God, please.
If Disney paid us, would you still torrent their stuff, or would you?
I would assume that the advertising package comes with a free login, you know?
Oh, well, okay. Fair enough. all right. So is there anything else you wanted to mention before we get into spoilers, Mike? Any, let's say, Goose, pro or anti?
Pro. What are you, crazy?
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. That's the layup of a question. Goose is great. Goose is the best. Yeah, he's awesome. But anything else before spoilers, Mike?
I think you mentioned it earlier too, just like the entire supporting cast I think is awesome. Ben Mendelsohn's great. Maria Rambeau,
Played by Lashana Lynch.
Yes.
Who, yeah, I think she's actually like, I think she doesn't have enough to do in the movie, but she is great when she's
yeah.
there.
Yeah, that whole relationship, that whole thing is awesome. Annette Bening's, like, I think she's just cool in this movie. I don't know, like, what's going on. But it's sort of like Glenn Close in Guardians, right? Where she's like Nova Prime or whatever.
Right. But at least Annette Bening in this movie feels like a more important character than Glenn Close did in Guardians.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Oh, absolutely. But I just mean, like, wait a second. What are you doing here? But I guess that kind of speaks to just like the power of the Marvel movies at this point, where you can get like literally anybody.
Literally, yeah.
And it's the dopest. So, like, just everything surrounding the periphery of the movie is awesome. But I think it's time for spoilers.
All right, let's do that. Let's move on to spoilers for Captain Marvel, starting right now.
Stop it! Both of you! You're spoiling everything!
All right, spoilers for Captain Marvel, starting right now. Hey, Mike, this week I watched a movie that takes place in the 90s about an amnesiac woman who discovers that she holds incredible powers that link back to her mysterious past. She teams up with Samuel L. Jackson on a journey that ultimately ends with her confronting the man who made her lose her memory in the first place. But enough about the long kiss goodnight, Mike.
You son of a bitch.
Boom!
Wow. Whoever saw that coming?
Me, because I'm a huge fan of Long Kiss Goodnight. And I think I made you watch that movie once, right? Didn't I?
You did. Yeah, it's great.
It's a great movie. Anyway, there's a few big reveals that happen in this movie that I think were actually really interesting. I mean, I think the movie's big reveal is that the Skrulls are actually the good guys this time around.
Yeah.
You know, which was kind of a big deal. I mean, okay, so the idea is that the Kree have essentially demonized the Skrulls and treated them as outcasts, and the Skrulls in this movie are refugees trying to find their way to safety. And I think this is actually, like, genius for a few reasons. I think, A, as a metaphor for what's going on right now in the world, it's solid.
Yes.
And B, as a misdirect, it's something that threw everybody for a loop. It works. I mean, the Skrulls are almost always the bad guys in Marvel Comics, right? And so any kind of comics nerd watching this is like, oh, Skrulls, bad guys, great. And then and then you top that off with casting Ben Mendelsohn as the main Skrull, who plays the bad guy in everything.
Right.
So when he was cast as the main Skrull, I remember seeing that, and I was like, well, I mean, it's kind of obvious casting. Like, it's, you know, I'm getting kind of bored of Ben Mendelsohn playing the bad guy over and over again. But, like, whatever. Like, he's good at it, I guess. But then it turns that casting choice from, like, obvious and kind of boring into something very inspired. Because now you know they cast him specifically because it would enforce that reveal. Like, we're used to seeing Ben Mendelsohn play the bad guy.
Yeah.
And then once he's revealed to not be the bad guy, Ben Mendelsohn is a blast in this movie. He's so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was genius. A lot of people, I think, or some people at least, assumed that the next major arc they would do would be like Secret Invasion or Secret Wars or whatever it is.
Right.
Where the Skrulls, you know, infiltrated the government and the superheroes and like all this stuff and nobody knows what's going on. And that'd be the next big, you know, instead of Infinity War, we're going to do Secret War or Invasion or whichever one it is. I don't remember. So, like, yeah, what a pump fake. Like, beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Right. And I think they theoretically could still do that kind of stuff, like Secret Invasion or whatever, because I feel like this movie does play lip service to the idea that, like, these Skrulls are okay and they're refugees and they're trying to, like, make their way back home, but they also kind of, like Ben Mendelsohn has, like, a line at some point where he's like, yeah, you know, we're trying to make our way to safety and, like, what the Kree have done to us is wrong, but also, like, it's war. I am kind of a war criminal as well. And,
right.
Like, and they do kind of mention that. And so I could see, like, you know, a version, theoretically, like we're never going to see this period of the Marvel Universe again. Like, the next time we see the Skrulls will be present day.
Right.
And so a lot could happen in that 20 to 30 year span. So, you know, who knows what could happen there. But I think also what makes this reveal work is that we've seen the Kree as the bad guys once before in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right. So that was the thing. I need a refresher from you, Mike, perhaps.
Okay.
The Kree we know is like Ronan and stuff, or Ronan, or whatever the hell his name is.
Ronan is a part of the Kree, but in Guardians, I think what it is, it's like
he's like a separatist, right? Like he's his own thing.
Yeah, he's a member of the Kree, and he like believes in the Kree ideals or whatever. But he's like a radical, and he like kind of goes off and doing his own thing. And Korvath is part of his thing as well. Jaimin Hunsu's character in
yes.
this movie.
Yeah.
He was also the guy in Guardians who Peter Quill says, like, I'm Star-Lord. And he's like, who?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, like, that's an awesome callback. Well, not callback. He's, like, a main character. But you know what I mean? In this.
Right. Yeah. I thought it was cool to see him again. And like, it was kind of cool to see Ronan again, too. I feel like, you know, Ronan doesn't really do anything in this movie. Like, whatever. I was more excited to see Korvath in this movie.
Yeah. I thought he was a much cooler piece of connective tissue to the rest of the universe than Ronan.
Yes, because Ronan, it really just feels like they kind of wedged Ronan in. He mostly just appears via hologram for most of the movie.
He got snoked, basically.
He got snoked. But with Korvath, you know, he's part of, like, the Kree team that Captain Marvel is a part of at the beginning of the movie that is eventually revealed to be evil. But so you kind of get that, like, sense of, like, yeah, like, you see Korvath and it's like, hey, it's the guy from Guardians of the Galaxy. That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
And you don't really get a sense of, like, what he's been doing in the 20 years since, but you don't really need to. He's just, like, part of this team. And then, you know, eventually he's working for Ronan. And that's kind of like, you know, right. I don't really need like a Korvath solo movie in that in between.
But no, so my confusion, or, you know, it's been a while since I've seen Guardians 1.
It's been a while.
It's been a long, long time. And my confusion was I thought Kree was the name of like the empire or whatever civilization that Nova is part of. And Nova, or is that like a completely separate?
I think that's not the case. Yeah, no, okay. Kree is like Ronan's type. I mean, usually people with blue skin, but I think they occasionally have human, because Jude Law was also Kree and everything.
Right, so two things. So, like, that kind of confused me, where I couldn't remember, like, what the Kree were, so, like, when the reveal is they're bad, I was like, but they're good in Guardians, right? Because I thought that's what, like, I was like, that's such a weird turnaround. But then also, so, like, with Jude Law, I enjoyed his character. Jude Law is awesome in everything, basically. So, like, that's cool. But to speak to your, like flat lighting issue, like, problem, I thought he's, like, purple/pink in the beginning. And then by the end, he's just, like, normal Jude Law. And I was like, what? Like, I can't. And that might have just been because, like, the beginning of the movie is very dark.
Yeah, that's probably it.
You know, they do, like, this weird fluorescent lighting, and that was, like, the one... Jude Law was the one character I noticed was, like, I can't tell... I can't see him. I don't understand what's happening.
Yeah. But, anyway, yeah. So, I think the way it works in Guardians, at least, is that, you know, Ronan is, like, a Kree separatist rebellion sky or whatever. And the Kree are sort of in peacetime at that point in time, I think?
Yeah, I don't remember.
I believe that's how it worked. And they might have even been attacked. Like, it has been a little while. It's been about a year since I watched Guardians, I should say, because it was, you know. But I've also watched, like, you know, fucking 300 movies since then. Who knows?
Yeah.
But they might have been attacked in the Kree homeworld at the end of the movie. I would have to rewatch it to fully remember. But I believe the way it works is that the Kree are sort of in peacetime, but it's like a tenuous peacetime at best. Like, it's one of those things where it's like it's sort of recent peacetime. And I think at one point Nova Corps contacts the Kree to tell them about Ronan and what's going on, and the Kree kind of like, yeah, well, whatever. But they're very ambivalent about it or whatever, or they don't help out or something.
I do remember something about, like, a treaty.
So, and that's kind of the thing here. So the Kree are at war with the Skrulls and all that kind of stuff in this movie. And, of course, Jude Law is the actual villain of the movie.
Right.
Which was sort of a surprise. I didn't see that coming, but again, the Kree are the villains of the Guardians of the Galaxy, so that tracks. And I think he turns out to be a pretty great representation of, like, male gaslighting women.
Yeah.
And a much more subtle riff on toxic masculinity that builds to this amazing catharsis when Carol just, like, fucking annihilates him with one laser shot at the end.
yeah, that moment, like, when he does this whole, like, now's your chance to prove whatever... And she just fucking lights him up, and she just says, I have nothing to prove to you. Was like, yes. Fuck, yes. That was the most badass thing ever.
Yes.
I loved it.
Yeah, that was awesome. I saw somebody online kind of equate that to the kind of angry online bros who shout, like, debate me! To, like, those...
Oh, yeah.
And, like, it makes sense. That totally tracks. But, yeah, so the fact that Jude Law was the actual villain of the movie was also, I think, a nice reversal. Because when this movie was cast, I feel like it was heavily rumored that Jude Law was playing Mar-Vell, that he was supposed to be cast as Mar-Vell, or that was, like, the thought process, like, oh, well, Jude Law's playing Mar-Vell, or, like, everyone just assumed it.
Yeah.
And then so, you know, he kind of turns out to be the villain, and then it's revealed that Annette Bening was actually Mar-Vell the whole time. And Mar-Vell in the comics is the mentor to Carol Danvers and the original Captain Marvel. And everything that happens with Annette Bening's character, it's like, yeah, that makes sense. That totally makes sense that she would be Mar-Vell. And, you know, Mar-Vell is usually a male character, or at least in the comics, he pretty much always has been a male character. And everyone assumed that's who Jude Law was going to play. And so I like the way that played out. I'm not sure how much weight that reveal carries for, like, non-comics geeks, but I thought it was neat.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought it was cool that, you know, that reveal, Annette Bening is named as Mar-Vell, like, that kind of, that's the Captain Marvel, like, explains that name in-universe. Because one of the things before the movie was, like, how are you going to have someone in the Marvel universe named Captain Marvel? like in these movies that kind of take themselves sort of seriously with like continuity and stuff. Yeah. It's like you can't really have a fourth wall break that in that regard. I'm not familiar with the backstory of the comics of how that name comes about. So like I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm waiting for now that they've seen the box office receipts. I'm waiting for DC to greenlight Mr. DC. Or I guess Mrs. DC. They'll want to be like more. They'll want to get in the female empowerment. cash. I would say. I mean, you mentioned that this movie doesn't really like play up the '90s setting for laughs that much. I would say for the most part, like, when it does reference the fact that it's in the '90s, it kind of does. I really didn't feel like it did that much with the '90s setting. I was kind of hoping it would do more with it. You know,
really.
I think the way Kevin Feige was describing the movie is like, oh yeah, we basically made a '90s movie or whatever, and like he wasn't really clear. He wasn't really clear on what that meant, and I'm not really sure what I wanted. But like maybe I was like, oh, this will be like fucking Bad Boys or something. Like it'll just be crazy Michael Bay action or something like that. But like '90s movies traditionally were very like bombastic action movies. Like those kind of '90s action movies were huge and crazy, and like you know there was an action sequence every 5 minutes. And this movie isn't really that,
no.
You know, and it's a much more I think spare movie than the '90s movies, and that's fine. It doesn't really feel like it does that much with the setting though. I feel like you know it does the Blockbuster thing, it does the Radio Shack thing. You know, you look around Blockbuster and you see a True Lies standee, and she destroys Arnold Schwarzenegger's head. And it's,
yeah,
funny. I did think the Stan Lee cameo was really clever.
Was he reading a Mallrats script?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he was reading the script for Mallrats, which of course Stan Lee made a cameo in.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and he's like practicing his lines, saying like, "Yes, true believers," which I think that was a very clever cameo. Also, I love Mallrats, so I was pretty excited about that. But I also think it's a cameo that breaks the entire Marvel universe if you think about it too hard, like I did. Because then it's like, well, wait, but if you watch Mallrats, he references Spider-Man, he references Hulk, and he's referencing all these characters, but they didn't exist in the '90s in the Marvel universe.
He's an observer. No, not observer. Watcher.
He's
what do they call?
He's a watcher. Yeah, he's a watcher. I mean,
so he's seen all time. He's one of those characters from Fringe. No, which are the observers.
but then you got to wonder, like, well, what is Stan Lee famous for in the Marvel universe? if he's famous enough to make a cameo in Mallrats, my thinking is that Mallrats is just a different movie which happens to have Stan Lee in it. You know,
yes.
And he is in it for different reasons. Like maybe he's the great novelist that he wanted to be before he got into comics or something.
I guess my original critique of naming someone Marvel in the Marvel universe, we can't break the fourth wall, is gone now. Because they just did in that.
Because they just broke it, yeah. But I did like that Stan Lee cameo. I also really loved that that Stan Lee opening, which was that was a nice surprise. I did not expect that to happen, but the movie opens with the Marvel Studios logo, but instead of all the characters that you usually see in the logo, it was just all Stan Lee and all of his various cameos from the movies. And then it ends with like a note that says, "Thank you, Stan." And I was like, that was nice.
That's really nice.
Good. That was really cool. But you were going to say something before I started talking about the Stan Lee cameo. What were you going to say, Mike?
Yeah, I guess my fear with some of that stuff is the whole joke just becomes that it's the '90s, and there are a lot of it, like, you know, when she modifies the payphone to talk to Jude Law's character, which had like the weirdest name that I can't remember, like Yunrug or some shit.
That's exactly what it was.
Is it really? Yeah.
Yeah.
talk to Yunrug. And it's like, you know, put in 50 cents for a long distance call or whatever. Like, you know, that was kind of funny. The loading the audio thing in the computer. And I'm like, we just have to sit here and wait for it to load because '90s computers are slow. But it didn't hit that beat, that joke, too often, which is what I was afraid. Like, sometimes that becomes the only joke in these kind of movies where, like, we set it in an older period and the whole shtick the whole time is that it's from a different time period. That was all I was worried about.
Yeah, whenever I think of that, I always think of the line in Titanic when Billy Zane's like, "Picasso, he'll never amount to anything."
Yeah, exactly.
And to Captain Marvel's credit, there was no line where somebody was like, "Bill Gates, that square."
Yeah, what a nerd.
He's never going to make any money. Now let's go fight bad guys. what did you think of the soundtrack in the movie, Mike? The heavily '90s alt-rock soundtrack.
I mean, it fucking shreds, dude.
I mean, fair. I mean, on the one hand, I think all good songs. Like, and yeah. You know, '90s alternative rock is exactly my shit.
Yeah.
So, like, I was pretty all about that. But I also think that, like, you know, soundtrack curation, especially for movies, it's I think it's about more than just having a good collection of songs. And I feel like with this movie, it kind of just feels like they're kind of just randomly playing without, like,
yeah,
that much. Like, compared to, like, something like the Guardians movies, right, where James Gunn, like, was very actively selecting those songs. And his personality and the movie's personality is shown through the music. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is just like playing a bunch of 90s songs because it takes place in the 90s, and that's kind of the thing.
There was one scene that was very poorly executed and one scene that like came real close to being dope for me. The poorly executed one is, I think, after Carol remembers where she's from, I think.
Is this the Come As You Are scene you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where it's like, why is there, why? Like, other right. than, like, nice touch, it's the 90s, you remembered.
Yeah, I mean, A, I think it's an on-the-nose musical bit because it's like, the lyrics of that song are Come As You Were, As You Are, As I Want You To Be, and that's kind of
yeah.
what it is. But also, you know, that song, and I'm going to get pedantic music critic for a second, but, okay, in the timeline of this movie, Carol left Earth in 1989, and she returned in 1995. She's gone for that 6-year period.
Right.
She missed the entire career of Nirvana. unless she was a huge fan of their first album, Bleach, which nobody listened to at the time.
Is that what album Come As You Are is on?
Nope, that's on Nevermind, which came out in 91. And that sequence, like, it would be fine if Come As You Are just played in the movie, but that sequence is like a sequence where it's kind of drawing on Carol's memories and her experiences, right? She comes into that area, and Come As You Are is playing, and it seems like it's playing, like, it's not, it seems like, it doesn't seem like it's playing just as a soundtrack cut. It seems like it's playing like a weird echoey kind of thing, so it sounds like it's like actually part of the scene.
Yeah, I mean, the camera sits on the record player, like on the turntable first.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Which means that Come As You Are is literally playing in the scene based on Carol's memories, but Carol would not have any memory of the song Come As You Are because it came out in 91. Unless she heard it, like, sometime after she crash landed back on Earth in 95, which
is possible.
I guess it's possible, but they don't show that. Like, they never play the song before that moment.
Yeah. So, yes, I agree. That is a very weird thing. I would have never thought of. And then the other scene that came so very close, I don't know, like, if it was just the sound mix or what. It's the big fight scene on
Just a Girl.
Yeah. Like, that's one of the dopest bass lines or, like, opening riffs and, like,
yes.
Very empowering. It's fucking awesome. But I wanted that song on a, like, 12. I wanted that as loud as possible, and it falls very low in the mix to me.
I 100% agree with you on that. And I love No Doubt. I love Just a Girl. And it's another very on-the-nose song to play for that sequence. And I don't, like, that's a non-diegetic song. That's a song that's not actually taking place in the actual scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's happening just on the soundtrack. So I don't have as big an issue that it came out in 97. But
no, but it's, like, fine.
But it's a good, it's a 90s song, and it's a good song for the scene. And, you know, it's just, it's the combination of, again, these fights, like, as far as the fight scenes go, that's probably the most well-shot one.
Yeah.
But it's still, like, not great. Then you have, like, yeah, the sound mix just isn't there. Like, it just feels like it should be, it should be big and bombastic. I hate to keep comparing it to the Guardians movies, but it's weird. Like, you have these perfect example, like, these perfectly soundtracked movies within your own universe.
Right.
That you can, like, refer back to. And for whatever reason, this movie, I mean, I think a lot of that is that James Gunn had a hand in those movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously he directed them.
but had a hand feel like kind it's of, his touch, like, that was him.
Yeah, exactly. And this sort of feels like it's a conscious choice by, like, probably a committee of people to be like, what is the most fitting song to put into this to put into the scene? It's Just a Girl, and also the sound mix is bad.
Like, I was like, I'm fine with the sound choice. Like, it fits that scene so well. Like, you know, that what's happening and, like, Carol's realizing her powers, and that song is awesome. And, like, when that riff kicked in, I was like, fuck yes.
Right.
It just the mix did, like, the mix brings that scene down. Like, I seriously think if that song, if there was no sound but that song, like, because we hear the fighting grunts and, like, all that stuff, and, you know, like, typical fight scene sound, it would have worked more. Or if it was just louder than everything else, like, I just want that shit on 11, and it would have been dope.
Yes, I 100% agree with you on that. Again, I like the song, and I think it's a fine choice for that scene.
Yeah,
it's just, you know, it's like, it just feels like, like, it feels let down by the sound mix. It's just so, it's so weird.
It's such a weird thing, yeah.
And it's like, that seems like such an important thing to get right for that scene, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe it was the theaters that we saw it in. Maybe when I watch it on Blu-ray, it'll kick ass. But anyway, let's get off that for a bit. I did want to mention Carol's relationship with Maria Rambeau and her daughter, Monica.
Yes.
Because I love them. They were great together, and I wish more time was able to be spent with them. Because, yeah, Lashana Lynch is, arguably giving the best performance in this movie outside of Ben Mendelsohn. But she just feels sidelined, you know? She feels like she's part of the... and I sort of felt this way with Nick Fury, too. Like, he's along for the ride, but he doesn't really do anything, for the most part. For mostly what he does is just to kind of hold a cat for most of the movie. And right. That's great. That was great. Like, he's amazing with that cat. I want a solo movie of just Nick Fury and Goose.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I love Goose. Goose is great. Maria Rambeau, though, I hope they come back at some point. Like, it seems like she should be a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent now, right? Like, from the where this movie goes.
Yeah, I could see that. But the only thing is, like, if we're going to revisit these characters, that we would have to see them, like, 25 to 30 years older.
Yeah.
That you would have to put old age makeup on them, or old age technology, or whatever it is. Like,
you just film it with the de-aging stuff and then play it backwards, and it's old.
Yeah, I think that's how that works.
Uh-huh.
I do want to mention another cool reveal, actually, that I think actually really worked in regards to all the prequel-y stuff. The Tesseract.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it turns out that, you know, Mar-Vell has been working with the Tesseract, and that's kind of where her engine, or like her science engine, whatever, came from.
Faster than light, or speed of light engine, or something like that?
Something like that. Thank God we invented the Tesseract machine.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the Tesseract is what gives Captain Marvel her powers.
Right.
In the movie. And so I think that was a kind of a cool way to work in the Tesseract and kind of allow us to know, like, oh, hey, this is how S.H.I.E.L.D. got possession of the Tesseract by the time the Avengers rolled around. Because the last time we saw it the last time we see it before then is at the end of Captain America: The First Avenger, where it kind of drops in the bottom of the ocean.
I thought I saw somebody mention, it might have been a Film School Rejects article, which raised a bunch of, like, questions, but a lot of them were really dumb. But there was one in this one, it felt like very weird nitpick things, where at least according to this guy, I forget who wrote it, said that it's established that Howard Stark dug it up after the events of Captain America, the first one.
Yeah.
I thought so. I can't remember exactly what it was.
Okay, I don't remember. I'm gonna rewatch all these movies, and I will be nitpicking them like hell. You can
report back.
I don't really care that much, but I thought it was a cool reveal that was part of it and all that stuff. That was pretty cool. I think the some of the other prequel-y stuff was less successful for me. The very last shot of the movie, I'm curious what you thought of it, which shows that Carol's nickname in the Air Force was Avenger, and that's what gives Nick Fury the idea to name his team the Avengers, right? He calls it it was the Protector Initiative.
Right.
And now it's the Avenger Initiative. And I don't know. To me, that was like, and your name is Solo from Solo, a Star Wars story, you know? It's just, it felt like superfluous. Like, nobody was asking why we called the team the Avengers, you know?
Yeah. That felt to me, I was kind of fine with it. It did feel to me, though, like, them telling the audience to be ready that she's in charge now, right? You know what I mean? Like, that's,
I don't know about that necessarily. I mean, obviously, she's already, like, the most powerful character in the entire universe at this point.
Yeah. But I just mean, like, when, presumably when Captain America dies and she becomes the leader, it's because it's her name. Like, it's just, like, a weird, it felt like a primer to me for that that twist, which we all know is coming.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, that was to me that landed a little bit flat. I do like the idea that, like, you know, Nick Fury was inspired by Captain Marvel to start to seek out for, like, the Avengers and start,
yeah.
Like, that was the reason why he became, like, you know, the kind of the guy who looks for heroes and that kind of thing. Like, having that added in just feels like a little bit much. I do think it does almost kind of work for me because they were able to play Alan Silvestri's Avengers theme over the scene,
right?
And so it kind of gives it a little bit of, like, extra heroic, like, oomph, you know?
Yeah, I had in my mind, you know, like that 1 second before when he picks up the picture, whereas, like, before we see what the picture is, I thought the name of the plane was going to be Avenger, and I would have been, like, okay with that, if that makes sense.
Okay,
you know, or like the model of the plane, like, it was going to say Avenger on it, not that her name, like, her nickname was Avenger.
Okay. I mean, I think if it was just the name of the plane, I think it'd be kind of dumber.
Yeah, you think so?
I think so.
Less on the nose. I don't know.
I mean, if it was just the plane, like, what? At least with, I mean, at least with it being Captain Marvel's name, there's, like, a little bit of emotional resonance there. Like,
I mean, yeah, that's fair. I feel like
I realized what I was just criticizing about it, but, like, I don't know. For, like, I feel like it would be even less consequential. It would be even more inconsequential. If it was just like, and that's the plane, and we're going to call it Avengers now.
That's fair, yeah. But that's just what my mind went to first, like when he picked up the picture.
Right.
I was like, oh, okay, that works too.
Okay, yeah. And then it cuts to credits, and it's Celebrity Skin by Hole, which is a fucking banger, so I was pretty excited about that. also, did love Nick Fury's obsession with Goose the Cat. We've kind of, like, alluded to Goose throughout this review. We haven't really talked about what Goose is.
No.
And, you know, I think I was a little bit spoiled on this, because, like, I, you know, there would be, like, Marvel put out, like, a poster that was just Goose and that kind of thing. And, like, they would be... And so, and people would comment, like, oh, he's more than just a cat. Like, you know, comic geeks would be like, oh, wink, wink.
Yeah.
So I like, knew going in, like, there was probably something more to this thing than just being a cat. And turns out, yeah, he's not a cat. He's instead a Flerkin, which I guess is a cat that can swallow people with its octopus mouth.
Yeah, he's an Eldritch Horror, which is amazing.
And I saw that. I was like, yeah, all right. I'm along for the ride. Whatever. Let's see where this goes. But yeah, he and Fury are great together. And Fury's just a blast to watch. Like, just kind of like, just being like all cute around the cat. Like, it's just such a different side of Nick Fury than you usually see.
Yeah, I did really love the running gag of how he lost his eye.
Yeah, you know what? Well, here's the thing. And I would have rather the movie just never addressed it, that how Fury lost his eye. I would have rather he just had two eyes the entire movie.
Okay.
But the reveal that Goose is the one that scratched it out, like, it's pretty funny. Like, I enjoyed that. It was solid. But I would have rather just been like, all right, and he has two eyes the entire movie, and we're not doing the eye thing. Like, because I know as soon as it was a prequel and Nick Fury was in it, people were like, oh, man, we're going to see how Nick Fury loses his eye. And I'm like, I don't care about that. Let's just keep going.
Yeah.
It just doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. But to play it off as kind of a joke, I thought was like, yeah, it was solid. And I think it does change a lot of things. Like, there's a line in Winter Soldier where Nick Fury, I think, says to Captain America, like, last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye. And, like... And I guess he was talking about the cat.
Yeah, and like I kind of love that. Like
I
saw somebody, I think in that Film School Rejects thing, that was one of the things. He was like, "Was he really talking about a cat?" And it's like, yes. So he trusted, like
he trusted
tried
the cat
to save, like it saved their life multiple times. It ate the Tesseract, like it protected them from the Tesseract and stuff. Like I don't know, I thought that was really funny that it makes that line. Or the relation that line makes his relationship with Goose have so much unnecessary weight, but I love it.
Yes, yeah, I do like that, and yeah, it just I like the idea that Nick Fury has been like lying about how he lost his eye for 25 years or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, that would be funny too. Like, is there ever mention it any time else? Like, if it's different story every time, like the Joker scars thing. That'd be very funny.
I don't think they ever do that, no. But he always like alludes to it. Like,
yeah.
I think he says like I got my eye on you and that kind of thing. Like I don't think he usually says like a very like different origin stories.
That'd be really funny though.
That'd be really funny. But yeah, speaking of S.H.I.E.L.D. agents, I mean, I kind of would like to see more Coulson in the movie, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, he's basically a glorified cameo, and it's nice to see him. Like,
right.
It's fine. Like I don't really know where he would have fit in this movie, but after like he's been absent from these movies for so long, mm-hmm. you know. And Coulson was like just a very early fan favorite of these movies, right? Like he was a delight early on, where he was kind of like this grounded S.H.I.E.L.D. agent who was just kind of excited to be around all these superheroes and stuff. And really, most of that characterization came from the Avengers, actually. But it was applied retroactively. But and then you know you had Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. afterwards, so he has been on TV for like 6 years at this point. But like the movies don't acknowledge that. Like
no.
As far as the movies are concerned, he's dead. Actually, I'm a spoiler for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I haven't watched the most recent season, but I heard that Coulson died again. I think
what? How dare?
I think Clark Gregg is coming back next season, but not as like the Coulson that we know. It's like some kind of other Coulson.
Is it a Skrull?
Maybe. Who knows? They have dealt with Kree on the show before, so...
Ooh.
Yeah. But the movies will never acknowledge it.
No.
So this could probably be the last time we ever see Phil Coulson in a movie. And so the fact that we only get, like, a little bit of it, like, yeah, it's... You know, I would have liked to see a little bit more.
Yeah, I was kind of disappointed, because, you know, he gets replaced by the Skrull in that scene, you know, in the car chase stuff. And I thought that car chase was very 90s and awesome. When they're chasing the train and stuff. Yeah, I thought, like, it seems like he's going to have a much bigger part because he's there in that whole car chase and stuff. And then he's like, oh, you guys left me behind. And, like, we kind of do for the rest of the movie. Like, he shows up one or two more times.
Right.
And, you know, he's the Coulson we know already, going by his morals and stuff. And I thought that was cool.
Yes. Anyway, what did you think of the credit scenes in this movie? I mean, so there's the first one, which is a mid-credit scene, which basically was, it looked like it was just a clip from Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
But there's no way it wasn't.
Right. Like, it's going to be.
It's directly from the movie, which they've done a couple times in the past. I know after Ant-Man, like, there was a Civil War clip, right?
Right.
And it was after Doctor Strange, there was a Thor Ragnarok clip when Doctor Strange shows up in that movie.
Right.
So, yeah, this movie has a clip from Endgame where it's Captain America, Black Widow, Bruce Banner, and Rhodey looking, you know, all worried and, like, bummed out because, you know, half the universe is dead. So, like, yeah, I can see them being bummed. You know, they mentioned the fact that they found Fury's pager, and it's been, like, you know, still, like, the symbol is still there, and then it disappears, and they're like, oh, what happened? And then suddenly Captain Marvel's there, and it's like, where's Fury? And then it cuts to credits, and then it cuts to black, and it's like, Captain Marvel will return in Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
So did that scene get you appropriately hyped for Endgame and for Captain Marvel's appearance in that movie?
I mean, yeah, especially with the context of the way this movie ends, right? Like the absolute fucking insanity of like how just powerful Captain Marvel is.
Yes.
Being able to fly through a ship and destroy it, like, was fucking badass. and then she just flies off into space, like, outside the spaceship. I was like, yes. So yeah, like, with like the way that, like, the hype of that moment, and then, like, yeah, fucking the person that's gonna fix everything is finally here. Right. And that was cool. I'm like, you know, I don't know how I feel about, like, you know, the first couple times this, like, where they just use a clip from the next movie as the mid credit scene have, like, kind of annoys me sometimes.
Okay.
Just because I feel like, I don't know, just save it for the other movie. Because if like, especially, I forget which one had the clip with Captain America and Rhodey. No, Falcon. Like,
That was the Civil War clip that was at the end of Ant-Man, I think.
Yeah, like that one specifically, I was like, come on. Like, I don't know, like that one didn't get me hyped, and it just was like a regular scene in that movie.
Right. Well, it was a scene that teased Ant-Man was coming in the movie, basically.
Right, that's true. But yeah, I'm excited by the mid-credit scene in this. Like, yeah, I'm excited to finally see all fucking 78 characters or whatever it is be in Endgame.
Yes, definitely. I am looking forward to that. And then the other post-credit scene is just Goose on Fury's desk puking up the Tesseract.
Which is, like, sure. Goofy.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. And I think it would have been even funnier if it wasn't the Tesseract and it was just, like a Kree that it had swallowed up or something.
I kind of thought it was going to be, and I was like, that's pretty dark, actually. Or like a Gaboot or something like that.
Right. Yeah, just like a normal hairball.
Yeah.
Or then it opens its mouth and you can see the glow from the Tesseract, but it doesn't come out or something. I don't know. But the puking up the Tesseract was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And yeah, it does kind of just connect those dots where it's like, and now you know why S.H.I.E.L.D. has the Tesseract in the Avengers.
Right.
So any other thoughts about Captain Marvel, Mike, or should we start to wrap this thing up?
I think it's going to be real interesting to see, like, looking ahead, especially in Endgame, just, like, what they do with her powers. Like, we sort of referenced, she, like, catches a missile in midair and, like, flies through multiple ships, I think, and destroys them. So, like, it's just going to be weird to see them be, like, how, like, she's already so powerful.
Yeah.
Like, is there a balance? And I don't know, like, do we need that? Like, does it matter that she's going to come up in, like, One Punch Man to Thanos? Because that'd be fucking awesome.
I mean, here's the thing. And I think, you know, I think Captain Marvel should be a key supporting player in Endgame. I don't think she can be the main character in that movie, or one of the main characters. Because it's really the culmination of these stories for Captain America, Tony Stark, Thor, like, all these other characters that we followed for several movies at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of supposed to be their ending. Right.
And
while simultaneously acting as a beginning for, like, characters like Captain Marvel and Black Panther and stuff like that. So I feel like the brunt of the, like, emotional crux of this movie has to be with those characters that we've already spent, like, so much time with at this point.
Yeah.
But Captain Marvel will absolutely come in and wreck shit. Like, we know that. Like,
yeah. I was specifically just referring to, like, her sheer power. Like, she's going to just show up and, like, level Thanos in a punch, right? Like, that's...
Well, that's the thing. I feel like, you know, they have to figure out a way where that she can't do that, basically.
Yeah.
Because otherwise there's no movie. You know what I mean?
It's just a 10-minute short film. Like, that's it.
Unless they kill Thanos within, like, the first 5 minutes and then go back in time and, like, reverse all the other stuff that happened in Infinity War or something, and that's the actual movie. You know? Yeah.
I saw somebody joking about, is she going to fly backwards around the Earth and save Lois Lane? Which, like, sure, I'm in.
Yeah, hey, why not? She just pops in and she's, like, carrying Amy Adams, like, yeah. Suddenly, like, I saved you from the other universe, and now she's in the Marvel movie.
That'd be great.
I would love that. Anyway, yeah, so that's Captain Marvel. I was a little underwhelmed by a lot of it, but I also enjoyed a lot of it. And it sounds like you enjoyed it a little more than I did, Mike.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to watch it again, and I think a second viewing will help the movie out in some in certain ways. I'm not sure if it'll help out my problems with the action scenes and stuff like that, but like I think now that I've gotten a full picture of like where the movie's at thematically and this is kind of the way the story goes, I think I will be able to appreciate some turns the movie takes a little bit more. But yeah, that is Captain Marvel, and it doesn't matter what I think because the movie made so much money this week.
Yes, and I'm glad.
This weekend, yeah, which is great. I'm happy it did. Because ultimately, even if I didn't like this one as much as a lot of the other Marvel movies, like it's an important movie in the Marvel universe and for blockbusters in general, because we're going to get more movies that are like it, and that's good.
Yes. I was just going to say, I'm excited to do, and I'm not going to do a full rewatch the way you are. I'm going to try to do like a best of greatest hits, you know, kind of thing.
Okay. That's kind of what I did before Infinity War. I watched like, you know, the first Iron Man, then Avengers, and like a couple of the other ones.
Yeah. So I'm excited to include Captain Marvel in that.
Nice. So are you going to like go back in theaters and see it again before?
I mean, if it's still around, probably, I guess it'll still be out by then.
It's going to be, yeah, it's going to be out in like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is my plan. I mean, you got to get on the AMC Stubbs A-list, bro, so you can just go see Captain Marvel for free.
It's a struggle.
It is a struggle. But anyway, that about wraps up the 100th episode of Film Bookcast, and also our review of Captain Marvel, which was part of the 100th episode of Film Bookcast. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
And you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter, and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thanks for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriccio. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to contact us, hit us up, MikeandMikeGoToTheMovies@gmail.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a review of the new movie from the visionary horror filmmaker behind such works as Key and Peele and Keanu. that's right. We are talking Jordan Peele's new movie, Us. Pretty excited about that one, Mike.
I'm so scared. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, I know. It just had its South by Southwest premiere. And I've heard good things, but it is going to be scary. It's going to be intense.
It's going to be great.
And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we'll be discussing the documentary, The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, detailing an unmade Nicolas Cage Superman movie from the 90s, directed by Tim Burton and written by Kevin Smith. One of the great unmade stories of all time. So I'm pretty excited to check into that. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Thanks for listening to 100 episodes of the show, by the way. It's, you know, we couldn't do it without you.
Yeah. And now, like the hobo from Polar Express, we're going to fade away.